Previously on Lost.
You cannot change anything. You can't. Even if you try to, it wouldn't work.
Why not?
Whatever happened.
Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason. Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
Horse?
You know Morse code.
You gotta find me, John. You gotta find me. And when you do, you'll find him.
Who?
Jacob.
Two players. Two sides. One is light. One is dark.
We have to go back!
We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast for Season 5, Episode 7, The Life and Death of Jeremy Bentham. Guess what? Charles Widmore has given you a dumb, snooty alias. What is it? My name is Dave Gonzalez, but according to Charles Widmore, I am Slowpoke Gonzalez. Racist.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and Charles Widmore has decided to call me Diotima of Mantinea, and here's why. First of all, there's not that many female philosophers out there. Secondly, something I found out about good old Diotima as I was scrambling to find a female philosopher is that apparently her ideas became the foundation for the notion of Platonic love. So ain't that just the way? She had the idea, Plato gets to name it after himself. Great stuff. Moving on.
And I'm Neil Miller, and Charles Widmore has gifted me, because he is a fan of philosophers and Monty Python, the name Socrates McGillicuddy III. And I'm gonna do some nefarious things with this alias.
Good old Socrates, always a classic. If this is your first time joining us, welcome. This podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or visiting the island for the very first time. Each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. The first is a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers. Then there's a second section we call The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series and over a decade of Lost fandom. The division in these two sections is becoming very important once again on the television show Lost. So make sure you're only listening to the things that you want to listen to. If you look down at your podcasting device, we have listed out time codes so you could make sure not to go too far into the storm or just skip over parts of the calm once you've heard enough of that. Or hey, just keep going all the way through. We're going to try to keep it snappy for you. If you would like to support the podcast besides just listening, and thank you very much for doing that, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, and there you will find ways to support us at a monthly subscription rate that will also get you bonus content. That's bonus podcasts. That's access to our Patreon Slack with a whole bunch of nice listeners being nice to each other. That's Watches of Lost, the new episode, every Saturday before we talk about it. Monthly movie club, book club, which is now becoming like a Zoom thing. And Joanna's doing some bonus podcasts. One is February Thirsty Movies, and her and Dave Chen talk once a week if they have something to talk about, and recently has had several episodes about very deep pop culture topics. It's Chen Pop. Joanna, Chen Pop's been, it's evolved.
Oh, has it? Yeah, we had a really good, and by good, I mean there was a lot going on last week, so we had a lot to talk about. Last week's episode I thought was really, really good. So if you haven't given it a listen already, I would really recommend it. That's for our $10 subscribers, or if you're a $10 subscriber to Dave Chen's Patreon. We're doing all these like Patreon crossover episodes, basically. But basically, we talked about Joss Whedon, we talked about Gina Carano, we talked about Minari at the Golden Globes, we talked about Britney Spears. So there was just like a lot to talk about. The thing I love about talking to Dave Chen is, we don't agree on a lot of things, but we disagree on a lot of things too. So it's really good to, but it's always sort of convivial and respectful. And this is a chance for us at the $10 level to get like really, I guess, unfettered in the discussions that we have, because, you know, we figure that if folks are paying $10, then they don't want to like willfully misunderstand us. So there's like benefit of the doubt, if that makes sense. And that makes it easier to talk about some really tricky subject matter. So
it makes sense if you've listened to the episode, which I encourage everyone to do.
So there you go. That's bonus content for you this week. Today, just today, it's Tuesday. We put up part one of Feels Like a Thirst Time, where Kristen and I talked about Coyote Ugly, Magic Mike, XXL, and Mr. and Mrs. Smith. And I played a couple games that I invented for Kristen. One of them was I gave her some names and I asked her if they were the names of the characters from Magic Mike, XXL, American Gladiators, or actual literal male sex dolls that I looked up on a sex doll website. So that was just one of the games I played with her. So we had a good time. Go check it out. That's Feels Like a Thirst Time, Feels Like First Time. We're doing thirsty movies. Okay. But that, of course, you don't just have to listen to us talk. You can always talk at us. You got a couple ways to do that. You can email us, host@stormpodcast.com. We got some all-timer emails this week. We got one from our pal Grant, who's been on the podcast before and who I owe. I know, Grant, if you're listening, I know I owe you an email that is split into the calm and the storm because it's so long and I couldn't bear to cut any of it. So we're going to chop it up. We're going to talk about some Grant concepts and some other great stuff. We got some antagonist related emails, but they might not be what Dave wants them to be. You can also go to our website, stormpodcast.com. You can tweet at us at stormpodcast. That's where you can vote on our weekly Kistery poll. The Kistery poll this week is a pretty hilarious. I'm pretty excited about who won. We will talk about that. You can also leave us reviews. We love getting reviews. So let's hit a couple of that. A couple of those, let's say. All right. So this first review is called, it's from Zach Brady. It's called Time Traveling Review, written on Valentine's Day. Thank you, Zach, for this Valentine from you to us. 5 stars. Zach from February 2021 here. Lost is my favorite show, and I always find myself coming back to watch it again. This time around, it's with the Storm team at my side. Much like all the other reviews, I want to say these are fantastic hosts with a variety of perspectives and a wealth of knowledge. I was a little less than 3 years late to the party to follow along with this podcast live from the beginning, but at my current watch/listen rate, I should be caught up to live episodes before the end of the show's run in season 6. Leaving this review here in hopes that it can be read on the show and I can have my own personal flashback moment when hearing it in the future. Cheers and see you in another life, brother. Zach. So Zach, whenever you hear this.
He ferreted us.
Whenever you hear this in the future. Damn it. Hello. Thanks for the review.
Well played, good sir.
And then this review, also 5 stars, comes from Rocco of RB. Fantastic companion to your Lost rewatch. As quarantine kicked in, I was looking for some good comfort TV and dusted off my season 1 Lost DVDs that I had never opened. Was immediately hooked anew, but so much less anxiety than watching the first time through. But I did miss that conversation with friends about the latest chapter of Lost. I found this podcast through the Queen, Mallory Rubin, her guest appearance on the show. That's in parentheses. It says the Queens, and then in parentheses is Mallory Rubin. And I kind of only want to refer to Mallory Rubin as the Queen from now on. The Queen, parentheses, Mallory Rubin, guest appearance on the show, and immediately started listening to the pods to catch up to where I was in my rewatch. I love the vibe of the podcast and the hosts have great chemistry. Chemistry among the hosts of a pod is the secret sauce, but there's more. You get right back into that conversation with well-researched content and opinion on each episode, but not Jeff Jensen-ish over-the-top rabbit holes. Loved your reviews on the first watch, Jeff. If I had a complaint, I love this idea that Jeff Jensen's listening to the review section of a podcast. Don't worry. He's not listening. You didn't offend him. If I had a complaint, it would just be that I want more episodes. A slow burn of once a week is good, but sometimes I just have to rip off a few episodes at a time because Lost is so much fun. Early on, I would sometimes skip the storm section just because I had forgotten so much since watching it live so long ago. Most of it has come back to me now since we were in the stretch run, so I am happy to listen all the way through. If you're watching Lost for the first time or your sixth rewatch, this pod is a great companion. Thanks, Rocco. Thanks to the queen, also, Mallory, for bringing you over there. Much appreciated.
Now we have to ask, when it's the queen, it's which bee is it? Is it Bay British or Binge Mode?
Okay.
Right? Right?
Do people say Queen Bee for the British queen?
No, but
I thought that was Beyonce.
Yeah, well, he said that, but then he said British. Well,
I said, when the queen, we have to ask which bee is it?
Beyonce,
the British one.
Okay,
yeah,
now,
see,
now, it's
a bee.
All right. So we have, as I said, we have a couple antagonist check-in emails actually that go sort of together, and I'm going to leave them for that spot where we're going to discuss it in the comm. So I think I just have one comm email to read, and then half of Grant's email to read here. Okay, so this one comes from Anna. I'm not going to read the whole thing. She gives us her lovely origin story. Thank you for the origin story. But I'm going to read it for the Kistry crossover question she put in here. Okay. She said, I've been meaning to write for a while, but I have so many feelings I didn't know where to start. Then the other day, my toddler daughter picked up my Locke and my Davos Funko Pops and made them kiss, and I decided it was time. And then she says, note, I wasn't able to sneak a photo of this exact moment in Kistry, but I'm attaching a photo of her making two different Funko Pops kiss as proof. And it's true. There's an adorable baby here making some Pops kiss. Who's kissing in these photos? Let's see. Oh, it's, what's the T-Rex's name from Toy Story? Just Rex, right?
Rex.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's Rex. And then, maybe Viserion, one of the dragons from Game of Thrones. So it's a dino dragon smooch and a really cute baby. Okay. So this brings me to my crossover question. If you could make any character from Lost and any character from Game of Thrones kiss, who would you pick? I would choose Sawyer and Brienne for obvious reasons. So I'm going to throw that over to you, Neil.
This is very hard, and I would like to reserve the right to adjust this later when I think of a better one. But I'm thinking a John Locke Varys pairing.
Oh, the Baldos?
Just making out and sharing secrets.
Ooh,
that'd be great.
Okay.
I don't know.
And like Baldos, I didn't mean as a derogatory. It's the same way I
right,
say
no,
beardos.
This
I
is...
just I appreciate all man beauty.
Speaking of beardos. I'm gonna take Desmond and Dario too.
Okay.
Oh, Dario too.
Long-haired beardo brunettes just smashing those beards into each other.
Okay. Desmond and Dario too. I'm going to go with Tormund and the polar bear.
No, listen. Here's what happens for my guy Tormund. He meets Juliet.
No, I don't think Juliet's really the Brienne analog you think. I considered that.
No,
and then I almost said Ana Lucia, but but then I went with a polar bear. So no,
that's fair. He would love the polar bear.
And then but I mean, you could Tormund and Juliet, sure. I mean, that's fine.
Sure.
I like all of that better than I like Tormund and Brienne.
I can't believe we didn't get a Jaime Lannister and Sawyer pairing out of this. Like, what are we even doing here?
But why would I have two of the same? It's like putting two ends of the same magnet together. Why would I do that?
Sure, I want to watch Elijah Wood French kiss a mirror, but is that a satisfying answer?
Okay. So they're mirror images, not like bookends. you know, bookends are great.
I mean,
as pairs,
time is, we're in the calm. I don't know, you know. So, okay, and then she has an answer. Anna has an answer question here about Alex's childhood that I'm going to have to answer in the storm. So please try to remind me to answer Anna's question about little baby Alex. Okay. Here's the first half. It's actually really only like the first fifth of Grant's email. But actually, there's a section of this email I'm cutting because Grant gets into the Bardo, the concept of the Bardo. But actually, he may not remember. We've already read a Grant email about the concept of the Bardo. So that is just material we have already covered. So thank you, Grant. But all this has happened before and will happen again. Okay. So here's the calm section that I think is interesting to talk about, especially as it pertains to this episode. Grant writes, when I rewatch Lost, I find myself asking the big questions, which is somewhat the intention of its creators. This show pits science and faith against one another, free will versus destiny, with tangent realities and afterlives and ghosts and time travel rolled into one six-season network television drama. You're discussing season 5, the time travel season, and I, of course, want to get in on the fun, but I feel like my commentary will veer quickly into what it all means and how deep into the show's history the concepts go. Back in season 3, when we were not in Portland, we visited Room 23, which features numerous subliminal messages fed to poor Carl. One was a simple blink and you'll miss it message stating, "We are the causes of our own suffering." It's a statement that reminds me of the first noble truth of Buddhism, that life is suffering. This is something we'd already spent several seasons exploring with the survivors of Oceanic Flight 815. We would experience an on-island story each week paired with usually a single character's flashback to some moment of suffering in their past. Damon Lindelof, when asked about time travel in seasons 4 and 5, said that it had been in the DNA of the show since the very beginning, referring specifically to those flashbacks. It was a coy response that referenced the writer's penchant for, I regret how Frenchily I just said that, that referenced the writer's penchant for nonlinear storytelling. But something else has been there from the very, very beginning, according to Lindelof, and that leads into a spoiler quote, so I can't read it for you right now. But I just think it's interesting, especially as we think about John Locke in this episode, to think about the "we are the causes of our own suffering" concept and time travel as you know, because this is, you know, we start on island with John Locke, and we have a traditional, complete with whooshing sound flashback episode, which is not something we've had for a while, to an on-island plot and a flashback of what happened to this person before they got here. So I think it's fun to bring back that idea of the traditional flashback, and especially as it relates to this concept of we are the causes of our own suffering, because I think that's part of the thesis of this very episode. So just wondering if you guys had any initial reactions to those ideas put forward by Grant.
I like it, but my natural reaction is to just think about it as like storytelling mechanics. Like if you have a whole bunch of television writers sitting in a room, I'm wondering if a flashback is that much different from a fantasy, is that much different from time travel, just in terms of how they're, you know, coming up with it. Like usually when I, you know, was starting early episodes of this podcast, we just ask, you know, how does the flashback relate to like the main story, and how does, you know, the process of making television through like montage and serialization strengthen or weaken that? And I think they've just gotten very, very good at different sideways ways to look at that structure ever since Jack had to fly a kite and get a tattoo, and they sort of bottomed out with straight up flashback. But I do wonder if time travel is inherently part of that, because also when I speak about time travel storytelling, I talk about how limiting it is. So you're right in the sense that we've finally come through a whole bunch of what appears to be very random, very freeform storytelling, but is actually sort of limited by like causal loops and things like that, back to a flashback structure that's more based on character, which I enjoy when it's done well, like it's done here. Whether or not they're going to be able to keep it together, we have to see.
Neil, thoughts, comments, concerns?
Yeah. No, I like it. And I like that this episode gets to do it and answer a bunch of questions that we have. You know, I think that, you know, one of the things that we put on any flashback is that it needs to start answering questions. You know, we're in the final couple seasons of this thing. But it keeps the big question open. Why? Why is John Locke alive on the island? And I think that's great because it's fueling the mystery, and it's giving us a lot of the information that we've been craving ever since he first turned the donkey wheel, as they say.
All right. So that's, those are some emails. We've got two more that we're going to read sort of like in our calm discussion. The last thing I want to say here in my section is that we will be having our weekly live watch of Lost this Saturday. We are watching an episode called La Fleur, which I have decided is maybe my favorite episode of the show. So,
I mean, it's definitely a top fiver. Let me for just most say, people like, that I've ever talked to.
Let me just say that, like, when we, not to put too many expectations on it, but like, well, let me just say that when we were like, when we have our monthly meeting about like who's going to host which live watch, I was like, mad dibs on this episode. But secondly, everyone else is like, yeah, Joanna gets to host this episode. Right. So thank you guys so much. I mean, we'll probably all be there as we usually are, but I will be your captain for La Fleur this Saturday in the Slack. Until then, I will be counting the hours until then. All right, listen, guys, we've been home. We're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of this pandemic. We've been home. God. We've been sitting around. things are getting a little dicey, but we're all trying to eat a little bit better in this sedentary lifestyle we found ourselves in. But healthy breakfast doesn't have to be boring. Magic Spoon has the amazing flavors you love, but without all the bad stuff.
Yeah, it's, in fact, Magic Spoon has zero sugar, is 13 to 14 grams of protein per serving, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. Only 140 calories whilst you're consuming that. It's keto friendly, gluten free, grain free, soy free, low carb, and GMO free. But what it does have is flavor. And you can get those flavors in 4 different kinds in the variety pack. There's cocoa, there's fruity, there's frosted, and there's peanut butter. I will say personally, recently started with the frosted, and I will say it was delicious. It tastes like what I can only describe is a popular brand of glazed donuts, but like in cereal form, which I found delicious. So I was like sitting there thinking, oh my God, this thing has protein in it. I could eat this forever. So while I'm eating that forever, I also discovered that if you mix the flavors together, it can be very good. So let me pitch this one to you guys. Cocoa plus peanut butter equals peanut butter cup.
Oh,
yes.
All of this, if you give a shot to Magic Spoon.
So you could go right now to magicspoon.com/storm and grab a variety pack to try it today. And be sure to use our promo code STORM at checkout to save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/storm and use the code STORM to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode.
Neil Miller, what happened on Lost this week?
Yes, before we can experience La Fleur, we must talk about The Life and Death of Jeremy Bentham, which is an episode that was directed by Jack Bender and written by Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse. Those are names that you should know by now. This episode aired on February 25th, 2009. We are very close to being like right with some sort of, I guess that would be what, a 12-year anniversary? Anyway, it takes place on the way back to the island, on the island, around the island, in thought of the island. We open with the survivors of Ajira Flight 316, our new friends, Caesar and Alana. We see that their plane made it to the ground in one piece and that the pilot and, quote, some woman took off with a boat. And we meet the man they found standing in the water wearing a suit. That man is John Locke. Off the island, we witnessed the events that unfolded after John turned the donkey wheel and flashed himself to the Tunisian desert. He gets his grotesque leg injury fixed and then forms a pact with Charles Widmore, who wants to help him get his friends to go back to the island. There's a war coming, you see. So Locke teams up with Matthew Abaddon and goes globetrotting in search of his missing losties. In the Dominican Republic, he learns that Saeed is very good and he's building houses and has no interest in going back to the island. In New York, he proves that he did not, in fact, forget about Walt. He then heads to California, where Hurley, Kate, and Jack all react very poorly to his suggestion that they return to the island. And as a bonus, he finds out that Helen died. Sadly, Matthew Abaddon also does not make it. Despairing over his failure to convince the Oceanic Six to return, John tries to take his own life, but not before being interrupted by one Benjamin Linus. In an extremely emotional scene, Ben talks John down, gets some last-minute folder material from him about Eloise Hawking, and then, like any true antagonist would, promptly murders him. It all ends back on the island with the Ajira survivors, as Locke helps Caesar unpack the fact that some of the people from the flight disappeared midair. They also find someone important among the injured, Ben Linus, the man who killed John Locke. Fun fact about this episode, Locke meets with Walt in front of the fictional Southfields Auction House, the same auction company that auctioned the BlackRock Journal to Charles Widmore in London in a previous episode that I can't remember the name of, but you guys remember it. This week's column question, we have now seen three versions of Jack's post-island facial hair. We have the clean-shaven Jack that boards Ajira Flight 316. We have the full quarantine, we have to go back beard. And now we have this, like, in-between scruffy look. And I would like to know, once and for all, which of Jack's post-island facial hair looks you prefer. Joanna, which is the best one?
It's clean shaven, honestly, because I think there's a version of like scruff Jack that actually would work well, but this scruff looks so fake. And I definitely cannot endorse depression beard Jack. So it's got to be clean shaven. That's not usually what I prefer, but in this case it is.
Dave, do you have a different preference in your Jack Shepherds?
Yeah, full quarantine beard, because then you know that exactly the Jack you're getting, you know? You're just like, he shows up, you're like, all right, I know exactly what to expect from this guy. He needs a hug, he needs to hear that I want to go back to the island with him, and he needs me to flush his pill down the toilet.
Yeah, he probably also needs a therapist, but, you know, that goes without saying.
I think all versions of Jack probably need a therapist.
All right. Well, I think I agree with Dave. I think full quarantine beard. I mean, ultimately, I think the message here is that Jack needs to pick one way or the other. He needs to just keep shaving it or keep the depression beard and let it just go. That's the only two. He can't. This in-between stuff isn't working for me, is what I'm saying.
I basically agree.
All right.
We're here at the life and death of Jeremy Bentham. Before we get into the lock of it all, we do get our formal character introductions, as in we get to know their names for Caesar and Alana. We let you guys know last episode when they appeared on Ajira Flight 316, just because it had been announced they'd be characters, and if you were watching Lost and were as into Lost to be listening to a podcast when it was happening, you would have known those characters. But now we actually get to see some of them. They seem to be, like, in charge, as opposed to the last time we saw a plane go down on the island. Frank manages to put this plane down a bit softer, but there is also immediately seems to be some sort of power structure. I don't know if they're working together, because Caesar is keeping some secrets, like a gun that he finds from Alana. But it does seem, in terms of we're suddenly on an unexpected island, these two people have their stuff together. But it also appears like later on, when Caesar is talking to Locke and Locke talks about the Dharma Initiative, they're unaware of the truth of Oceanic 316, because it appears that Caesar doesn't even know that Locke was there for 100 days.
815, you mean?
815, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay.
316, 815. I'm totally never going to make that mistake again.
I do also think it's very interesting that the show, having just emptied its cup of background people and red shirts. And meat socks. Sorry. After emptying the cup of meat socks, it has been refilled by Flight 316 and the campers who are now with Caesar and Alana and Jan Locke.
Love to restock the meat sock supply. I mean, can't wait meat to see them. Restock. Can't wait to see them die in fun and exciting ways. Flaming Arrows Run 2, anyone? Can we say where they are? Because it's in the recaps at the time.
Sure.
Okay. Eagle-eyed viewers. Well,
there's some... Yeah, good.
Eagle-eyed viewers at the time, I found a Hydra station logo.
Mm-hmm.
So they're on Hydra Island.
And there's a shot at the end when Alana and Locke are talking on the beach where you can see the other island.
Mm-hmm.
So it's clear that they're...
Yeah,
so on they're on one of, you know,
Bear Cage Island. We're back.
And Frank stole a boat. Bye, Frank.
Frank, I mean, and some woman classic stole Frank. A boat.
Classic
Frank.
But
classic Frank and some say, woman, you know.
No matter what happened, it's clear that Frank brought that plane down in one piece, and he's continues to be a hero, as far as I'm concerned.
Remember, like, the first time they were like, where did the helicopter crash? And he's like, crash, fuck you, I landed it right there. This is genuinely classic Lapidus. Crash, I land my shit, thank you very much.
Remember that one time I gently landed a helicopter in the water and there was a baby there? Yeah, I'm the best.
And the baby survived? That's me.
The baby survived.
I rule.
Yeah.
Sure, we can't use his real name anymore because of reasons, but the baby's alive.
Yeah, he's alive. His mom's a brunette now. It's fine.
Which is one of the things that's not our official podcast check-in, but on this week's official Lost podcast, Damon and Carlton do get a question about if Kate killed Aaron. Like, they're like,
dark.
Oh, Kate's really sad, and she doesn't want Jack to know about Aaron. Did Kate kill Aaron?
This and is like the Jeff Jensen theory that, like, Son's kid was dead. All the kids are alive.
Wow.
It's fine.
I don't want to spoil anything, but there aren't any dead babies yet. Even that on the sides.
That is the darkest Kate theory I've ever heard.
Well, the show's real dark. I don't know.
It's true. This is one of the darker episodes of Lost, though.
Not a lot of hope in this episode, I think, until its mysterious conclusion. But it's, I guess, sort of at war with itself as an episode, because at the end, I think you have a lot of mixed feelings, whereas as you're going beat by beat, this episode is very good at building to its climactic Ben and Locke scene, but really... really punching Locke in the face with his blind faith, sort of hitting walls at every corner where he's trying to recruit people back to 316. I guess we should start at the beginning, which is Locke pops, or at the beginning in terms of furthest back in time. After turning the docky wheel, Locke pops 3 years into the future, to the Tunisian exit, as Charles Widmore calls it, and at least we have a name for it now, to the exit point, where Widmore's people manage to fix up his leg. And we get a whole bunch of background on Charles Widmore, like he was the leader of the others, like there's a war coming to the island and John needs to get back. Neil,
mm-hmm.
How much do we believe old Charlie?
I mean... Charles, as we've seen him be a foil for old Benjamin Linus, I think if you're assuming that Charles, like Ben, is almost always lying, you're in good shape. I mean, he seems like one of those kind of guys. Although, I need to stop. There's one detail about this Widmore-Locke scene that I love for how hilarious it is to me that while they were putting this episode together, they made sure to get that one line in there about how Widmore flew in a specialist to fix Locke's leg, because they knew someone would, if they just fixed it in this like desert, you know, outpost hospital that did not have a surgery room, or they were like, someone's going to ask about this. Have him mention the specialist.
I like that this is where they're like, someone's going to ask about this.
This is where they're like, there can be no questions.
Yeah, about seasons of Jack doing whatever the fuck he wants to do. And this one, they're like, oh, well, we're off the island, so we should probably mention a specialist.
It's very rich, Lost. It's very rich. But yeah, no, I mean, I think we are meant to be skeptical of Charles Widmore. But it is also interesting how quickly Locke sort of, I don't know if he's like acceding to it, or if he's going along to, you know, accomplish his own means. Like if Locke is using Widmore as much as Widmore might be using Locke. But it is more cordial than I would have expected, given that Locke, as Widmore explains, Locke has also heard terrible things about Charles Widmore. I guess when he met Widmore as a teenager, he looked into his soul and was like, this guy might be okay someday.
But also he's like, oh, you had my horrible job too? We were both in the others? Let's bond over that.
Yeah. The revelation that Widmore used to be the leader of the others, I think, stands out as being very important here.
Does that really degrade Locke's pride in being, oh, wait, they made you right. the boss too?
He's like, wait, so it was Ben was one and you were one?
I'm in that trio? Oh, no.
Maybe it's good that I left.
I might start a new feature on this podcast, which is plucking out my favorite Jeff Jensen nicknames from a recap. Because he loves
A more wholesome version than like Sawyer's nickname of the week.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't like writing them all down, but this one stood out to me as I was like, oh, Jeff, he called Widmore Megabuck Chuck. So there you go. Good old Megabuck Chuck Widmore.
Old Chucky Wids.
There you go. Yeah. And not only that, but doesn't Charles say that Ben like tricked him into leaving and took his spot? Well,
he exiled him or, you know, was the reason why he had to leave, I guess. Something like that.
Does he say tricked? Anyway, I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, now we know why he's super mad at Ben, I guess.
Right, and it highlights that thing he said earlier when he tells Ben, like, everything you have is you took from me. You know what I mean? Like, including my job.
My job as the leader of the Island of Magic. He's very mad.
Well, the reason I asked that is, Dave, are you still here? Are you still alive?
Yeah, no, I'm looking up the transcript. And what Charles Widmore says is he's afraid Ben might fool Locke to leave the island, but that Charles was exiled. So he doesn't accuse Ben of actually tricking Charles. He accuses Ben of tricking Locke.
Okay. So the, you know, there's the story of Jacob and Esau and how, you know, from the Bible, we've heard the name Jacob, obviously, a lot. But the story of Jacob and Esau is about Esau losing his birthright to Jacob. They're twins, right? And Esau is tricked out of his birthright and goes to Jacob, and they have this like fight, you know, they father nations, and those nations fight forever because of this thing that happened with these brothers. And so just that idea of like a birthright, you know, is it your birthright to lead the others? Is that what we would call what Charles had, what Ben had, what Locke had, and who's the trickster here? I mean, it's always Ben, right? So anyway.
Well, yeah, and then the wars that are fought over the rivalry between basically two people. And you know, that's something that Widmore tells John Locke in this one, that there is a war coming, and that I guess John Locke's on the right side of it as long as he's cool with Charles, I guess.
Question mark.
That's the biggest, I think that's the thing that Charles Widmore says, that it's like, wait, what are you talking about there, guy? Like, that's the you can't just say that and not explain. But
you're the on only TV thing show, that makes me think that Charles Widmore might be telling the truth is it all like kind of works. Like, Charles says, you know, that Locke has to get back to the island or they're going to lose the war, and that's super important. And then John dies, but we've already seen that if the island's not done with you, it won't let you die. So the fact that John does die but then comes back seems like the island's power is going to make things happen. Like, John has to be back in order for this war to be waged. I'm just trying to figure out, so you have Charles, and you have Ben, and you have John, and they've all been put on a continuum now of people who think that they're special because they're leaders of the others, but I'm trying to pin what everybody's hanging their faith on at this point, because John's seen Christian Shepherd in a cabin. We don't necessarily know what Ben's seen, but he's been doing the work of Jacob for decades.
Ben saw his mom in the woods.
Dead mom?
Yeah. His dead
mom. I think that counts, yeah.
Yeah.
And then Charles, we don't know, has had any supernatural experiences based on what we've seen or
except
heard
for the part time where travelers? He met a fully grown John Locke when he was 17.
I mean, I think that's different. That John Locke wasn't like, you, Charles Widmore, you're going to be the, you know, the leader of the others. I'm wondering, like,
but
do
he
we
saw
know...
people, like, blip out of existence, you know, right?
Lots of people saw people blip out of existence. Caesar saw some Hurley blip out of existence, you know, just a couple hours ago. I don't know if that's
you
see some one guy blip out of existence.
A theory that Caesar is going to be the next leader of the others? Love it.
No, I'm putting forth a theory that... I'm assuming these gentlemen are hanging their faith on something they genuinely believe in. That's what I'm looking for. I know
but
Locke
does it
believes
have
in
to be,
island.
But does it have to be concrete? Or is that the Doubting Thomas sort of like Jesus binary? Do you have to
these are the guys
it,
that didn't
it.
Need proof, maybe?
Yeah, do you have to see a guy in a rocking chair in a cabin in order to believe that you are destined to lead these people?
I mean, maybe not, but that also gives more of an argument to me that Ben's right about Charles, because Charles has like a okay life where he's rich and gets whatever he wants, but he wants like the magic island. Ben and Locke have, you know, had very lonely, rejected by their mother lives that, you know, have led them to
rejected
you know,
by their mother. is that how you just describe Ben's mom dying? Well she had
Locke was
nothing,
rejected by his mother.
She wanted nothing to do with him, so she was just like, that's it.
Rejected by their parents, sure. Like to a certain degree. All I'm saying is that I get Charles Widmore comes out, he talks a good game here. He seems to be helping Locke on his mission, but I'm having trouble finding the center on purpose or because it's vaguely written of Charles Widmore outside of like a snake in the Garden of Eden sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Like you have to have somebody oppose Ben, but because it's Ben and because what Ben does in this episode, you kind of retroactively put a lot of faith in Charles, where I'm just not sure what's
well, isn't
island
this,
magic and what's Widmore force.
I mean, isn't this, you know, what Lost has been doing in a lot of ways? So think about what we, the audience, know about Charles Widmore. He's a bad guy. He hates Desmond. He doesn't want him to do with Penny. And he wants to make... he wants to do something with the island's power that someone along the line objected to. But I think this is the first episode where the show is trying to muddy the waters on Charles Widmore a little bit. If they're trying to get John to think that maybe he's not the villain that Ben has painted him. All the while Ben is like following John, shooting at John and Matthew Abaddon. Like, so I think this is the show doing its thing. I don't know if we know enough about Charles to be able to be like, was Charles truly a man of faith? But we know that whatever is driving him, whether it's you know, wanting to capitalize on the island's gift or some sort of faith that was based on an event that happened early in his life, it is driving him deep into his life. Like, he is very occupied with this task. So, we'll see. I think it'll be interesting to see where old Chucky goes here.
I like the thing that Joanna brought up with Jacob and Esau, because it is the idea that these two guys both kind of built nations, but I'm not sure what they're fighting about or which one's right. I'm just pretty sure they're devious gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. Well, the story of Jacob...
One, a proven murderer. The other one just yada yadas over Kimi in this episode to be like, sent some stuff.
I think the moral barometer of Charles Widmore not thinking Desmond Hume of all sexy people is good enough for his Christmas loving daughter Penny.
it's questionable
him.
At best. Yeah,
positions him. But yeah, I think the thing they're fighting over is control. I mean, I think the thing that all three of those men, John, Charles, and Ben, the thing that they fall into is this, like, I'm special. I'm put here for a reason. It's all daddy issue stuff, right?
I have a right to be the guy who's in charge of the island.
And no one
for whatever
reason. Yeah, no one can lead the way that I do.
Yeah. John, it's just because some random dude in a cabin told him. Like, that's not really that much.
John. So sad.
Well, maybe if it took him more than one episode to put his entire faith in everybody. It took two seasons for him to put his faith in the island fully. And then now he's just like meeting somebody and being like, yep, all right. Richard walks out of some time traveled jungle and says he has to die. And he's like, okay. And then, Widmore comes down and he's like, that seems like it's dumb. And John's like, oh, okay.
Wait, can I
and
ask you?
And he gets
you-
sad and he's like, oh, I failed. Okay.
I don't want, okay. Nope. All right. I don't, no, go ahead. I don't want to disagree with you necessarily, but I want to ask, my interpretation is that John is a true believer the minute he's able to use his legs on the island. Like, he's gooping people and doing all this stuff because he's a true believer in the island from the crash. So I'm curious what your two-season timeline is about, Dave.
I think he has to get blown out of the hatch. I think he has to go, I was wrong. I think he has to go all the way. Like, he has to find the definitions of the island.
So he has to get the faith, he has to lose the faith, he has to get the faith back?
Well, he gets on the island and he's like, is this a magic island? I'm going to do whatever it wants. And then he goes too far and kills Boone. And he's like, well, that's the sacrifice the island did. And then he has to go down and push the button and realize that's just John Locke and not the island. And then once he comes out of that, I think he's much more shaman directed in terms of knowing the borders of the island or saying he knows the borders of the island.
I think for me, I think it's just that John Locke is so willing to be led by anyone always that when he lands on the island, he's like, oh, the island needs me to do this and I got to goop something. He's sort of making stuff up. He's making up his own scripture because he's like, surely I'm walking for a reason. So let me just sort of grope around in the dark to figure out what that reason is. Should I press this button? Is that what I should do? Should I goop this young man? Is that what I should do? Should I do this? Is that what I should do? Always, always so eager to be led. And it's so funny because he positions himself again and again as a leader, but he's the ultimate follower. That's who John Locke is, right? And, it's because he's just so lost internally because of all the damage of his childhood and stuff like that. And, exactly what Grant sort of emailed us about, right. We're the source of our own, trauma, but Charles Widmore immediately weaponizes that in this episode, by saying you're special. and John immediately is like, okay. And then Kate's like, no, your problem is, you lack love. And he's like, oh, okay, I'll go find Helen. And then, Jack says you were never special. And he's like, okay, I'll go kill myself. And then Ben's like, no, you gotta live, dude. And he's like, oh, okay, I'll live. That's just John. He's just being tossed about by all these other people with a slightly sturdier sense of themselves and their opinions of the world. That's my interpretation of this episode anyway. So,
I mean, I don't think that's a bad interpretation of the episode. It's just not... It makes the intention of what the island's doing, what the people are doing, trying to get back to the island, like, so much muddier. But that's okay, because Lost is a show about the characters, not about the dumb island stuff we get obsessed with. That's the mystery they're going to solve next season, right? We still have a whole season of dealing with the characters before we get all the island answers. So I guess I'm not too concerned about that. I am a little concerned about how hard we're turning into Christian symbolism. And I guess I would want to ask you guys, as people who were active television watchers at this time, do you feel like that is specifically because this show wants you to think about the most famous resurrection narrative? Or is it because at this point in American broadcast television, that is considered the shared text so that everybody knows you're doing allusions to the New Testament? Whereas, you know, like, maybe only people who have read their Bible pick up on the Jacob and Esau stuff.
I mean, I have a question that I have in the notes here is like, is Lost more of a religious show than it is a sci-fi show? And are those concepts mutually exclusive? Like, obviously, like, the man of science, man of faith binary has been here the whole time. But I think with this episode in particular, and it's only going to keep growing, it's going to become a little less like Christian, a little bit more Judeo-Christian going forward. But like, you know, this episode and 316 and stuff like that are obviously just sort of like redolent with all of this religious imagery. And I think that comes down to Damon Lindelof as a deeply spiritual person who's extremely fascinated by God and God figures and faith and are we, you know, and you know, ultimate bad dads in the sky and stuff like that. And so like, and what that does to the suns, and I mean that in a gender neutral way, like on Earth and stuff like that. And so I just, I said that like we were going to skip over the part in Grant's email this week of that's about the bardo, but the bardo is like a Tibetan concept. I think that there, you know, Dharma is an Eastern concept. Like I think there are Eastern religious stuff cooked into the show. It's just not as easily identifiable for us. And this is, of course, is foot on the gas, the most Jesus-y stuff. That we deal with in the whole show is John Locke's body, you know, hanging from a ceiling, with the Judas cleaning up the crime scene and stuff like that. But I think that Damon Lindelof more, I haven't seen this in Carlton Cuse's other work, so I have to lay it on Damon. Like, this is just what he's fascinated by is God and belief and how that unifies all of us. Even those of us who are like atheist and agnostic, that there is just some, you know, because then our God is science or something like that. Do you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think that there was, especially as it was airing, there was a point where, you know, Lost, people started asking more questions about like more direct parallels to, you know, Judeo-Christian stories. And it's probably somewhere here in season 5. And it might actually be this episode where it's like, once you do a resurrection, right, and then people are going to be looking for every single parallel. And I do think that there's a point where they start to lean into it. And it'll be interesting to watch sort of as we go, because Lost has, for the most part, just treated it as the idea of just like faith in sort of any sort of godlike entity. And this is where we're starting to get a little bit more specific, it seems, or at least they want us to start thinking about more specific things. You know,
I think they tried to hit it pretty hard because we had that one Charlie vision that was based on Christian symbolism. Specifically. And I think that was an example of like, you have to know about like halos around the heads of saints from like art history or something to even get what that vision was trying to go across. Here, I feel like you're going to get Christianity even if you're not a Christian, because this is like, this is the story. that God so loved the world that, you know, he sacrificed his only son so that to get them all back to the island. That's what the end of the New Testament is. They'll go back to the island. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like like this is as close as it gets, but it's built to getting here by not giving us a whole bunch of like crucifixes and stuff. We've had some resurrection anagrams and some hieroglyphs, I believe. But that's not
reincarnation.
Reincarnation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But those are not, yeah, specifically the Judeo-Christian symbolism that we associate with this. There isn't a ton of cross symbolism, you know, that's in the shadows of everything like you would if you were doing more ham-fisted, straight Christianity. So I'm almost wondering, like I was saying before, if that's just... You're right that it's Damon Lindelof, but if at this point, if it's just shared text, like you can't do... this specific lost story without bringing up Jesus, because it's just all so tragic and ends in this reversal of rebirth based on faith. Like, you know, Jesus asks his father to not have to die, and God's basically like, oh, nope, gotta die. And then he does. And spoilers, comes back, happy Easter. All right.
it's funny because I was just, I was like a huge Lost fan when it was airing, but I wasn't writing about it. And so I wasn't necessarily thinking about it on like the granular level, that plenty of other people were. And I wasn't like following interviews with Damon and stuff like that. So it wasn't until I talked to Damon about The Leftovers that I really understood fully, like how important this idea, how obsessed he is, and I don't mean that in a bad way, he is with the idea of like religion and God and faith and doubt and feeling abandoned and feeling supported and stuff like that. It's interesting, like you think about Prometheus, you know, a largely reviled film, whether fairly or not, and we can't really lay Prometheus fully on Damon because he has talked about, I think, how Ridley Scott sort of really tampered with his original conceit and stuff like that. That being said, like the way that the way that Prometheus starts is the gods creating man. You know what I mean? Like that's mm-hmm. just all Damon Lindelof is interested in. And he's refracted it through all these fun different narratives, you know, like the Watchmen's about God as well. But I don't know. I think it's really fascinating to watch this one person wrestle with something that's so personal to them through these genre stories. Anyway, so that's how I, an atheist, you know, or atheist leaning agnostic, feel like I can really, oftentimes hyper religiosity turns me off. I find it unrelatable. I don't find Damon's particular strain of it unrelatable. I find it really humanistic, you know?
So. Yeah. Well, and I think that there's a lot of elements of him asking questions about, you know, just sort of the nature of faith. And I think that's one of the good things that they do here in Lost is like, I didn't ever really take Lost as like a show about any specific religion. It's more about the idea of religion and the idea of like, what does it take to either create faith or destroy faith, or, you know, I mean, in almost every character we can kind of, you know, try to work around where their faith is at any one moment and how that's directing their actions. And yeah, Lost does a really good job of it. This one is the most on the nose for sure that we've seen so far.
I think that's a really good point. And something that I think is interesting is that like some of the best people writing about, you know, I've been reading all these recaps as we've been getting deeper into the show, and the people who are doing the best writing and the smartest interpreting of Lost are critics or culture writers like Jeff Jensen, who is a very religious person, and Emily Vandervoof, who grew up in a evangelical, I believe, or fundamentalist tradition. Like Emily has talked to me a lot about her experience. You know, I don't really want to like speak for her, but just sort of like I was reading her recap and she was talking about like the way in which John goes to visit all these people, to visit Saeed, to visit Walt, to visit Kate, are the beats of a passion play. Like that's the way a passion play is structured. I didn't know that because I was not raised in a church, but I think that it's helpful to have those people who have that fluency with that kind of language, commenting on and interpreting this kind of storytelling, you know?
Mm-hmm. Fun fact about passion plays, they became a dramatic structure primarily during the Dark Ages because not a lot of people were doing entertainment for fun. But what you would have is traveling, what we would now think of today as theater troupes, but groups of people who would go around and put on the passion play. So it'd be like the passion play is fucking coming to town. Nobody's doing anything tonight. Like get out your candles. We're going to watch Jesus be tortured and crucified.
We're just going to watch everybody be terrible to Jesus. It's yeah. going to be great.
And that like evolved from like traveling passion plays to the Station of the Cross, which is still a dramatic form that's done around Easter, or like here in Colorado, we have a very famous one in Salida, I believe it is. That's a series of, it's the passion play told in different statues as you like walk up a mountain, then you get to the top of the mountain. And that's where Christ is crucified.
Oh, I see. It's a metaphor. It's the mountain.
Yeah, that's right. You could walk that metaphor. But yeah, it's this... I mean, a lot of European drama sort of gets baked in around Christianity because that's what it was okay to talk about at the time, which I think is where a lot of these things become like repeating tropes that we're still interested in. So it's always interesting to see a Jesus pop up, and I am actually going to give Lost bonus points for not just like straight up having Christian symbolism. I mean, it might have been deep in independent film at some point, but at least by the time I was watching indie movies in like the early 90s, the cross symbolism is the easiest. Work harder, be like Lost, spend 5 seasons building up somebody and then tell us he was Jesus. Then at least it's a lot more interesting, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Let's continue with more of those passion play Stations of the Cross, because some of them, very interesting. John Locke, unlike everybody else who has dealt with the Oceanic Six, visits Walt. Good old Walt.
It's somebody did not forget about Walt.
Yep.
John Locke was Walt's, and I guess what I like about it is that it shows that John Locke's like interest in being like friendly with Walt was not some like scheme to get him away from. It was like I think John genuinely liked Walt.
I think he genuinely cared about Claire and the baby too. Like there's a lot of stuff that some of us on this podcast have been interpreted as nefarious doings by John the whole time. And I don't think that's who John is at all. And I think we see it especially in this episode when he like doesn't go to see Son and he goes to see Walt, and you know, he's just sort of like, oh, okay, Saeed, you want to keep building house? Okay. You know what I mean? Like John doesn't have what it takes to manipulate people into going back to the island with him. Ben does, clearly. But John, he's just sort of like, no, who am I to do that? I can't do that to these people. You know what I mean? So I think this episode's so revelatory of his character in that way.
I think with the only exception is Jack.
Like the note for Jack?
Like what John intends to do by killing himself and leaving that note for Jack. That's like the closest he gets to an act of manipulation, you know? But in the end, it ends up being one of Ben's manipulations. So, you know... Island magic.
Do you think they switched this episode in 316's air order so we wouldn't be so distracted by hating Ben during that, or so we didn't hate Jack even more for Eloise Hawking being like, you have to bring them all back, and Jack's like, who's Walt?
No, I think, and Joanna might have brought this up in the live watch, I definitely think it's the first one.
It is really creepy having done last week's Calm podcast episode, not being like, oh yeah, I wonder what Ben's up to. I wonder what that thing at that discussion at the church was about.
Can you imagine how hard that scene at the end of last week would have been able to, you'd be screaming at the TV about the Ben stuff if we knew that Ben had done what he did in this episode. So I approve the switch. I think it's great. I mean, we're going to talk about this probably more next week, that these three episodes together, you could kind of shuffle them and there aren't really a ton of spoilers, but you know, for the three different things, but the Ben thing for sure would have been really like, it would have changed the whole vibe of that scene with Ben and Jack
in the plane. Yeah, I really do recommend folks go back, and if you're watching with us for the first time, I recommend going back and watching the Ben and Jack you mean in the church and in the plane.
The whole conversation they have where Ben's not like, oh, by the way, I killed John.
Yeah. He's like, oh, what's that? John's suicide note. Interesting.
Weird. John's dead? That's crazy.
That's wild. Hear that.
Who did they put anything about it in the paper? Or?
I don't know. I have no idea.
So John goes to Saeed, and Saeed's like, don't be a pawn. I was a pawn. Let's do some real good in this world. And he goes to visit Walt. And decides not to get Walt back. Goes to visit Kate. Kate has some hard truths. And may throw to Joanna Robinson for Joanna's least favorite Kate moment of the series.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even put it in the notes. But yeah, this is my Kate antagonist check-in. It is so mean. It is so mean what Kate, and cold, what Kate says here. Evangeline Lilly is great in the scene. And she does inject like a little bit of like empathy in what she's saying. A little bit. But like, I mean, so Jack's like riddled with guilt, grows a depression beard, starts trying to like fly on and crash planes and whatever after John dies. Kate is just not like, and if I were Kate and that was the last conversation I had with the man before he killed himself, where I was like, well, you know what? You've never experienced love. So, you know. How'd that work out for you, John? And then he killed himself. I would figure out whatever the Evangeline Lilly version of a depression beard is, grow my leg hair out, I don't know, and really spiral. Kate doesn't do that, but wow, I would have.
She just murders Aaron off screen.
It's a tough scene. But does bring it to the Helen of it all. Do we want to talk about that?
Yeah, let's do Helen and then Abaddon.
Great, because I have more information about Abaddon. Okay, so Helen Norwood, who we met previously, played by the great Kitty Sagal, Neil dropped this great joke in the live watch when we go to Helen's gravesite, where he's like, RIP Helen, lost to Sons of Anarchy, because Kitty Sagal was on Sons of Anarchy at the time. But like, and so we didn't find any concrete evidence whether or not they had ever intended for Helen to be in this episode and Katie was busy or whatever. But we decided we wanted to have a conversation about whether or not we thought the episode would be better if Helen were alive and rejected John in some way, or if it's better to have this sort of graveside, you know, scene. So I'm curious what you guys think.
I mean, I think it's definitely more efficient this way. That John can just process the emotion. Although, it's probably safe to say that anytime you can get a live-action Katie Sagal on your TV show, it's better than not having a live-action Katie Sagal.
Even so a it's cartoon like, purple ponytail Katie Sagal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, even animated Katie Sagal is great. So, yeah, I mean, I think this episode would have been a little different if they had brought Helen back, because I think that there's like a much longer scene that they would have had to do. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I guess there's a lot happening and they really needed this to be efficient. And you can see it either way, whether it was Katie Sagal is busy or we just don't feel like we have time to like bring the Helen story to a close in like one scene, one good emotional scene. It's just a lot more efficient to have her have already been gone, I guess.
I'm going to agree, because the only scene that could have existed in my mind that would have still, you know, kept the flow was he shows up, he says, you know, I'm here, and they have like a moment, but at some point he's like, and now I have to get all these people back to the island, and she's just like, this is your father all over again. I already time like I already tagged out of this. And it would be great, and it'd be a great scene, but it is actually redundant. And I
I think it would be great, and this is where the part where, you know, she would have been lost to Sons of Anarchy, because there's no way that this would have happened. But if John comes back and he goes to Helen and she's like, yeah, sure, I'll come to the island with you. Let's go. And then Katie Sagal is just on Lost for the last two seasons. That would have maybe been better, I think.
My name is Helen Hawking now. Dun, dun, dun! To the island!
I think that that option needed to be completely removed for John, in like the Job position, to be brought like completely low, right? This idea, mm-hmm. like any possible hope that he could figure his shit out and get back together with Helen had to be removed from him. And it couldn't even just be that she like married someone else and like had a kid with them or something like that. Like it had to be complete, that door had to be completely shut. And for him to have this like graveside moment, this like, can I do my book club corner really quickly here?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Yeah.
It's tangential. I mean, I think we know that the real book club of this episode is the Bible, but
literally just the Bible.
But I'm going to throw a Christmas Carol in there and say that like this moment is just like a real Ebenezer Scrooge. Like, we could have been happy if I had just had my shit together, sort of at her graveside moment. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, I think you.
Yeah, because if she's alive, then John might have a reason to abandon this entire plot.
Right.
Right.
And just be like, never mind.
You know what? Saeed is right. I should build houses.
Yeah, I'll build houses. I'll sell boxes. Who cares? Like, I got mm-hmm. Helen. But like, if he has nothing, if everyone is telling him, you know, everyone is just sort of like chipping away at him in this episode, as they are. I think the door being slammed shut on the Helen of it all is necessary. So,
mm-hmm. yeah, makes sense.
I still like my answer better because, like you said, Joanna, we're the architects of our own demise. And even if it was there, he wouldn't choose it because he's John Locke. And he loves
John
that
John would have screwed it up somehow, I guess.
He loves the island more than he loves Helen or himself or anything. It's sad.
Very sad.
All right, Abaddon. No, not Abaddon. Back to Helen.
Yeah. Okay, so Abaddon, this is Lance Reddick's, third appearance on the show?
I think? Third or fourth, yeah.
It's third or fourth. Well, he put together the team we saw in Flashback.
The Freighter team. He approached Hurley, he approached John. So anyway, he's been on a couple times before. We were trying to figure out whether or not he dies really abruptly here. This show does not have a great track record with black men and what happens on the show to them. So we were trying to figure out like what exactly happened here. And we know that Lance Reddick was on Fringe at this time. Since we started recording, I found the information that I wanted about this. Mm. So Lance Reddick, in a 2019 interview with The Hollywood Reporter, Lance Reddick said, "If I think about it too much, I'll get pissed off. When I was cast on Fringe, I was told that I'd be able to continue recurring on Lost. And then the very first episode that I did on Lost in the middle of Fringe season one, they killed me. So that was annoying. Don't get me wrong, it was a great episode, but I was like, what the fuck, guys? To be perfectly frank, before I was cast on Fringe, the intention was to have the character Abaddon become a series regular and major character in the season 5. And then being cast on Fringe just threw a wrench in it." So, yeah.
So it was Fringe.
I mean, but it was like...
Fringe antagonist check-in.
No, but it wasn't that like he was too busy on Fringe. It was like...
Right.
I think he had a conversation.
Robot shows fighting.
Yeah, and he was like, he's like, hey, can I take this Fringe gig and still get to do this stuff on Lost that you want me to do? And according to Lance Reddick, at least, his understanding was that he would be allowed to do that, and instead they just killed him off. So, I don't know. I'd like to hear what Damon and Carlson have to say about that. But you know, Lance, this many years later, like other black men who have worked on this show is pretty salty about what happened with this character. I don't really blame him. I mean, like, it feels really abrupt. You know, what happens here, right?
Yeah, and it has felt, and I think we've talked about this, like they were setting up Matthew Abaddon to be someone important, you know. And in this episode, it's kind of plays out that he's like, you know, he's Charles Woodmore's guy. And that, you know, would have been an interesting dynamic to keep going. But it's, they decided that it was more important to move on very quickly, you know.
I do have questions about that because, like, if he is Widmore's guy, does that mean, like, Widmore is the one who wanted John Locke on Oceanic Flight A-15 in the first place? Because Abaddon's the one who's like, Mr. Locke, ever gone on a walkabout sort of thing? You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, like, right, because Widmore knows Locke at that point. Widmore knows Locke.
True.
Well, they met in the 50s. Although it is curious as to, because it doesn't match with, isn't Widmore kind of surprised at the beginning of this episode when he sees John? Like, he remembers John, but I don't know if he like clocked John as being like super important. But I suppose the Abaddon thing does lead you to believe that Widmore had some knowledge of Flight 815 beforehand? No.
I mean, we have to assume that, but I think that's all retcon to when Abaddon was telling him about the walkabout. Like, at that point, he was still Lance Reddick, reoccurring character on Lost. Here, he's Lance Reddick guest star, so...
This is why we need more Abaddon.
The freighter stuff feels like Abaddon working for Widmore. It's just the John stuff that feels like a little curious to me. Anyway, we probably talked about this when he first showed up, but the name Abaddon is the name of a biblical angel of the abyss, Greek for destruction or the destroyer. Abaddon the angel is pictured as a human-sized locust and is known as the Lord of Pestilence. The root for Matthew is gift from God. So it's Matthew Abaddon. It's this very... heaven or
the very
devil or
destructive
angel.
Gift from God.
Yeah, devil or angel. What's going on here? So it just feels like he was just destined for something really big, and then didn't work out.
And then,
that's too bad. Decided. I think he's great in this role, and I think he's great in this episode. So kudos to him.
And he's
like
great
said,
on Fringe. Shout out to Lance Reddick.
And he's great on The Wire. And he's great on everything he does.
Oh, so good on The Wire.
All right, let's hit Jeremy Bentham and the concept of the greater good and then head out with our climax scene.
Oh, well, it's interesting that that's the name that Widmore chooses for John, because Jeremy Bentham's whole utilitarian concept was about doing, you know, if you, like, let's just say if Jeremy Bentham were to be presented with the trolley problem, he would pick the one that runs over one person for the greater good, right? Cue the hot fuzz, the greater good, right? So, like, and I think that does really describe John's, you know, Boone is a sacrifice the island demands. Okay, you gotta get a goop of Boone for the greater good. I'll do it. Gotta blow up a sub for the greater good. I'll do it. Problem with John is that, like, he's just not being given full, like, clear instructions. So he believes he's doing is for the greater good, right?
Yeah, I mean, even up to the end here, he believes that what he, you know, trying to kill himself is ultimately for the greater good, I guess. Maybe.
That's true. So John Locke, or no, Terry O'Quinn and Michael Emerson have one of the best scenes in the series, probably, in the John and Ben showdown that eventually ends with Ben murdering Locke. I hear we have emails about this.
We've got a couple Ben emails.
Is this not specifically about murderous Ben?
Kind of. I think it's a good place to talk about them. I think that's okay. Okay. I mean, you could talk about the scene specifically first if you want to.
I just think it's the show obviously knows these are the two powerhouse actors to go in and do it. And I think that the show is so happy that it manages to execute this scene in a way that's like full of tension and pathos and surprise and some actual genuine exchange of information with Locke giving up the name of Eloise Hawking. That it makes me forget all the things that we said Jeremy Bentham did in previous episodes that I didn't see Locke do this episode, like say the name Jeremy Bentham to Walt or tell Jack that a lot of bad things happened to the people who still left on the island. A lot of writing mistakes that I never think about, even when I'm rewatching the series, because I think the life and death of Jeremy Bentham works so well as an episode building to this point. Whether or not it undercuts it the second we get back to the island, I guess we could talk about later. But in terms of like big scenes of loss, this one really had to be executed with a lot of finesse, and both actors knock it out of the park. And Bender does a great job, especially with that Locke silhouette at the very end. Fucking heart-wrenching.
Yeah, I wonder if Jack Bender said anything weird to either of them before they were shooting. Isn't that a Jack Bender thing?
Yeah. Your father never loved you.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a beautifully acted scene, of course. Yeah. And what I love about it is the way, just in this scene, they build the tension. They build up this extreme emotional tension, and then they let the audience, the tension is relieved momentarily, and then something terrible happens, which is a scene structure that I personally love.
Yeah, the look on Terry O'Quinn's face of like trying to comprehend when Ben's like, Jack bought a ticket, is like, oh my god, we're out of it. Like, who thought all of this, that Ben was going to be the one to save Locke, and then nope, Ben's got a Ben.
Yeah, I mean, even though we know that John dies, we've seen him in a coffin, we have seen them coordinate refrigerated services to store his body, but still for a minute there you believe that Ben is gonna let him live, and it's like the show's like, wait, no, have you not been paying attention? He definitely dies.
Yeah, he definitely dies.
He's dead. You already knew this.
It's an extremely well written sequence. Yeah. And you know, I mean, I don't, did they get nominated for Emmys for these seasons, those two guys? I know both of them eventually got one, right? Emmy nominations? Terry O and Michael E. But I don't know if this was like the specific episode.
Yeah, I think Dave and I are frantically Googling while you're talking. Yeah, so we can have right? the answer for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it seems like that these would be ones.
Terry won his, I think, in 2007, so that would be before this, right?
Mm-hmm. So that'd been like a season three.
And then Michael Emerson won his
2009. He was nominated in 2000. This aired in 2009, so this would have been the 2010 Emmys.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. He for his fifth season. Yeah, so he won for this season. Mm-hmm. Is it for this episode? Maybe, but he's also got some other great stuff coming.
Yeah,
season,
there's
so.
Some. It's definitely some more Ben mm-hmm. stuff coming.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Ben. Okay,
yeah.
we've been doing this like John Locke antagonist check in, but I think it's very clear from this episode. Ben is our antagonist that we're dealing with right now, at least in this episode. Will you agree with that, Dave?
Yes.
Okay. So let's talk about, we got two Ben emails. This one comes from Eric, and it's actually in response to last week. And he says, hi guys, imagine my excitement as we come to episode 316, in which my all-time favorite TV character, Ben Linus, issues one of his greatest lines ever when Jack says, and the other people on this plane, what's going to happen to them? Ben replies incredulously, who cares? How is it possible that my favorite Lost rewatch team didn't even mention this? This is the quintessential Benjamin Linus ice cream sundae. Rich, delicious line reading with evil sprinkles on top. You mentioned Hurley saving the 78 people who didn't get on the plane, but no mention of everyone's favorite mass murderer showing blatant disregard for everyone else on the plane. I was so looking forward to Joanna giving a trademark laugh at this simultaneously hilarious and horrific line. I didn't know I had a trademark laugh. Good to know. Okay. By the way, Ben is also speaking for the audience. Who really cares about anyone other than our beloved Losties? Anyway, love the show and the hours of entertainment you provide, Lost Nation. Just give us more Ben. Benjamin's line is number one and forever, Eric.
Eric's absolutely right. And the only reason I forgot about that line being so quintessential is there's another quintessential Ben line that that will be coming up that always comes to my head first when it comes to Ben speaks about lines about himself. But you're right. Who cares is a fantastic Ben line.
What's your favorite, other than that one, which I guess we can't mention yet, what's your favorite Ben line-ness line? I'll go first. I'll give you first. Okay, first and give you time to talk. I forget. I mean, it must be Jack who says it, but maybe it's Locke. I forget who says it, but he goes like, "Well, I'm not you," and he goes, "No, you're certainly not." You know what I mean? Like, whoever said, "Well, I'm not you," was trying to take the moral high ground, and Ben was like, "You're certainly not me, because I'm better than you in every way. No, you're certainly not." Oh, so good. Such a good line reading. All right.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to call back all the way to, was it season two? Where he meets Michael, and he's like, "We're the good guys, Michael." Still one of the all-timers, because at that point we really didn't know anything about Ben, and it was like, wait, that can't be true, that's obviously a lie. There's gonna be a corner about that on a podcast someday.
I'm gonna go with, if I were the leader of the others, I would like the ambush people. You guys got any milk? Your people would be dead already. Got any milk?
Got any milk? All right. This email comes from Karen. She says it's called "The Problem with Ben Linus." So this is the flip side to Eric's number one Ben Linus forever, XOXO Eric. This is Karen saying "The Problem with Ben Linus." Hi, guys. I'm a longtime listener to the podcast and love it, and I've been a huge fan of Lost when it originally aired. I've always been troubled by the character of Ben Linus, despite Michael Emerson's incredible performance. I will not hesitate to agree that Ben Linus is one of the greatest television villains of all time. I would be interested to hear your thoughts on the character and how he affected the show. From the episode the character is first introduced in the form of Henry Gale, Ben Linus becomes a pivotal character in the show around which just about all the action revolves. As a result, the survivors of Flight A-15, those characters who had made the show such a stunning success through those first 38 episodes, become supporting players in the Ben drama slash chaos slash machinations. The list is long, but here are a few highlights of Ben's dominance in the various Lost storylines. Where's Walt? Ben is holding him captive. Why is her so mad? Ben stole her child and raised her as his own. Why does Michael turn on the rest of the survivors? Ben gives him a reason to. What happened to the Dharma Initiative? Ben killed them all. Why is the freighter here? They're here for Ben. Why does the freighter blow up? Ben gave Michael the bomb. Why does Saeed become an assassin? He's working for Ben. How does Locke get revenge on his abusive father, the reason he's in a wheelchair? Why Ben arranges it? Why do the Oceanic Six return to the island? Because Ben told them to. It's unfortunate that so many of the characters become sidelined once Ben appears on the scene, and boy, did they ever get sidelined. Even though he did not appear until the 39th episode, he misses a full one-third of the show. Michael Emerson ranks number 7th on the list of actors by screen time. I guess my criticism involves a personal desire for the focus of the show to have remained with the survivors of Flight 815 and the mysteries of the island, but as the show progressed, I feel Ben Linus and his conflict with Charles Widmore came to take center stage and dominate every single storyline, while the other characters, the ones I cared about, the ones I was emotionally invested in, slipped into the background. This email is too long already, but I'm interested to hear your thoughts on the character of Ben Linus as he serves the story of Lost. Karen.
I have a thought about this one.
Mm-hmm. Hit me.
So we were talking earlier about faith and sort of deconstructing the concept of faith, right? Mm-hmm. So you have, and we've been talking about these three characters. Well, specifically, you have different versions or different extremes of faith, I guess, in Jack, Locke, and now Ben. And I think the difference you get is, like, here we have Jack, man of science, who needs to get any kind of faith. We have John, man of faith, whose faith leads him to do all kinds of weird stuff that we don't approve of, but John feels bad about it along the way. Like, he mourns Boone, you know, he thinks deeply about some of the terrible things that he's done. He feels bad. Ben is sort of the more extreme version of that in my mind, where he's operating on a similar type of assuredness of faith that John eventually sort of has, or that, you know, this island sort of breeds in people. But the difference is that Ben believes that there is nothing too costly that he can do, right? Like, there's, it doesn't matter if like a bunch of people on a Jira 316 die. It doesn't matter that his faith is so strong in whatever his mission is, that, you know, he can murder the whole Dharma Initiative, and he thinks that he's doing the right thing, you know? And that's, I think, what makes Ben sort of a scary villain type character, where it's like, this dude believes that no matter what he does, he's doing the right thing. And it's clearly not always the case, you know? So there, that's my theory about Ben.
I like that overall. And I would add into Ben's increasing importance in the show that just shows he's a successful television character. I think it happens with Desmond. It happens with Juliet. If they add a character and that character pops with our Losties, that's the key, with the Losties, because you have Nikki and Paolo and stuff, which are like interesting, funny little boopity boop characters, but they never connect with our main group. So it like kind of doesn't matter. Then they get to step into the greater fabric. Does it feel weird that the show, at least especially right now, seems to be about this like greater fight between Ben and Widmore with the lost people in the middle? A little bit, but I think that's like a big expansion of the world building that is headed towards, they know they have X amount of episodes left and they're building to something. So I'm less worried about things happening like, we got Michael Emerson on the show, he's so good, we should write a whole character specifically so we could keep him on the show. Those things aren't going to happen anymore, I think, with the exception of like Abaddon maybe. They're whittling things down to the pure core. And if Ben's still around, then I think there's something that Ben has to do. Even if he's just the Joker chaos presence. You need that. You need that in these stories.
Maybe. I take this
Ben Linus, we live in a society meme.
How dare you intrude on my safe space?
Because now someone's going to make it, and it's really going to be...
The problem, as we've discussed before, is as there's more and more oxygen dedicated to Ben Linus, who I agree is a fantastic character, and I agree, Michael Emerson is incredible. And this is why, if you go back and listen, and I don't know why you would, but if you go back and listen to this podcast, we really hammer the introduction of Henry Gale and Michael Emerson, and like, oh my God, can you believe so much of the show existed before Michael Emerson? Like, it's kind of wild. Mm-hmm. But as there's more and more oxygen dedicated to him, it leaves less oxygen for Saeed and Sun and Jin and, like, you know, and Kate, and, you know, it's just sort of like, it tends to be the women and the people of color on this show who get the oxygen sucked out of the room as the show becomes increasingly focused down on Jack and Locke and Ben, right? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's fair. I mean,
and Sawyer, so.
They also killed off Matthew Abaddon in this one too.
Yeah. So, you know,
if you're doing math, it's, you know, it's not great
you're
decisions,
doing math,
but
another minority shot in the torso.
Ew. You can see how they got there with Michael Emerson. But yeah, no, I agree. It's definitely a pivot of Lost that it starts getting more into the mythology of the island than the plight of Flight 815 and its survivors, which I think is part of what leads to a lot of people formulating more and more mystery questions, you know, and it drives that. So then, if they were to, say, not answer some of these questions later, people might be upset.
Well, I mean, and this is something that I've said about Damon Lindelof before. Once again, like, I haven't been able to fully track the through. I don't want to erase Carlton Cuse and only talk about Damon Lindelof, but I have followed Damon's work more closely. And so then I will say that, like, if you watch The Leftovers, it starts off as a story that feels very centered on Justin Theroux's character. But, you know, winds up, the finale is called The Book of Nora. Like, it winds up focused on Carrie Coon's character, because that's the character of Nora is really the character that, you know, Kevin and Nora are interesting, but Nora just becomes, like, extremely more interesting. And then when he goes about to make Watchmen, like, he starts by centering Regina King's character. And so I think Damon Lindelof as a creator got better and better at moving away from characters who are so close to his own experience, and also by staffing his writer's rooms with different people with different experiences. You know what I mean? So this is, like, this is early days for him. And his evolution as a storyteller has been a real pleasure to watch, I think.
Yeah, and I also think that it shows a level of flexibility as a storyteller. Like, within the course of running his shows, he's willing to reevaluate characters and reevaluate who should be the center of who should be the center of the show. And you can see what they did here in Lost, and you know, that he just got made better versions of it later. You know?
Right. And to your point and to Dave's point, like, that's how story, that's how TV storytelling works, right? Because like, you have so much yardage to explore things, and like, characters are going to become characters that work, performers that work are going to, you know, you're going to have like, I have really dumb answer to this question just came to my mind, but like, I'm thinking of Emma Caulfield, the great Emma Caulfield, who's currently on WandaVision, but joined Buffy the Vampire Slayer as like a guest role in season three, and is made a regular in season four. Or James Marsters, like, these Anya and Spike are two of my favorite characters in Buffy. They don't show up till season three, and they become, you know, Spike more than Anya, but like, they become incredibly important series regulars because those actors work and those characters work. You know what I mean? So you gotta ebb and flow with all of that.
And I think it is a good lesson for the audience as well, which is, if you're in the middle of a show, if you're in the middle of, you know, season three of a show that will eventually become six seasons, that you don't know that at the time, but you know it's going to keep going, to keep an eye out for when shows make these sort of changes. And you know, that's the whole thing about episodic storytelling.
Speaking of episodic storytelling and how it affects the story, we saw a coffin at the end of season three, and we were like, who's in that coffin? And at the end of season four, we saw that in that coffin was John Locke. Now, because of the way that Lost has structured its storytelling, we get Locke being murdered by Ben and Locke's resurrection on the island in an episode, the same episode, so that even if you're really sad that, rightfully so, that Ben has murdered Locke, the end of the episode is literally a very alive Locke smiling down at a very beat up Ben back in Hydra Island, where we know they have a whole bunch of like bear cages and stuff. So it seems like John Locke, although being brought very low, we get to skip the 3 days in the ground because we've already spent so many weeks in between seasons with the dead John Locke. We just didn't know it. And get to get right to the resurrection and the mango eating. It all seems like John Locke is fine at the end of this episode, which does moment to moment make the climax scene between Locke and Ben even more shocking, because, you know, we've seen that Locke's alive on the island. We've seen that Locke's dead. You know, what's going to happen? Oh, there's still a murder. Like, I don't understand. So we're left with a lot of mystery at the end of this episode. But is it kind of, would it have been more dramatically potent if we would have had an episode, two episodes in between John Locke was murdered by Ben and John Locke
when
is alive,
Jon Snow comes back with a wolf brain?
Right. I was going to say,
well, we don't want a whole season of lies.
I think the more interesting question is which do you prefer, the show that answers the question immediately in the same episode, which is like, is John Locke going to stay dead, is the question. And this episode's like, no, he's fine. He's on the island. We've got more story to tell. Or do you prefer the show that kills off a character at the end of a season and makes you wait until the next season to find out that that maybe there was a way to bring them back? I really have always liked this, the way they set this John Locke thing up, because, you know, we spend a couple of seasons just assuming that he, you know, we spend the season assuming he's dead. But then when it comes time to really give the answer, the show finds a clever way to do it all at once and still have a bunch of questions out there. You know, like I said earlier, it's like the question of why still feels way more important than the question of how. Because at this point we're like, oh, right, the island does stuff. The island does magic. So yeah. Sure.
I guess, Joanna, does it read as the island does magic, or does it read as, I'm very sad for this guy. Oh, wait, he's Jesus. Maybe I shouldn't be too sad for him.
Oh, wait, he's Jesus.
Can he be Jesus animated by the island magic?
Yes, absolutely. I'm just saying, does it read one way or the other?
Jesus.
I do like this so much better than I like what happened with Jon Snow. Like, I was just trying to think of, like, at the time, what I felt like this was cheap. I feel like we weren't yet in the thick of, like, fake out deaths or whatever. And we don't yet know fully what's going on with, like, the island magic of it all. So, this doesn't bother me. I just sort of put that question in there. Like, does it feel cheap that, like, mm-hmm. you have this big death scene, but you know that John is, you know, walking yeah. around?
I mean, I think it so. Feels like it fits, you know, because on Lost, we've seen people die permanently and get buried and have funerals.
Shoppy! And
then we've seen people not die off screen or come back to life several times, Mikhail. And then...
Or we've seen people not die, be buried, but then die once they were buried because it was Nikki and Paolo.
Yeah, exactly. So we've seen the full range. And yeah, I think the thing I appreciate most about this is that even though we've spent, you know, a whole season being like, how did John die? What does this all mean? They were able to answer some of the big fundamental questions about that all in one episode. And I think that's what makes this one a particularly memorable episode outside of just the sheer brilliance of that scene between John and Ben.
Well, we officially have all of our Losties back on the island, so I believe we could start the day count again with everybody's back.
Yep, day one.
Day one.
Post Ajira. It's Ajira Flight 316, day one.
Day one. Volume two, Lost Volume two has begun. Everybody's back on the island of mystery. Mm-hmm. I think that means it's time for some corners before we head to the storm. Neil, do we have a Giacchino corner this week?
Yeah, there's one track from the season 5 soundtrack that from Mr. Giacchino. And I can't tell whether this is, this has to be a time travel joke, because if this is a joke about John Locke's death, very poor taste. It is called Locke's Excellent Adventure, and I think it's obviously about time travel.
Oh yeah, yeah, because the death one would be Bogus Journey. I mean,
right,
even
the bogus journey,
or an awfully big adventure, which is what Peter Pan says about death. To die would be an awfully big adventure. Yeah.
All right.
Our jungle of mystery moment. Just in case you didn't notice, John Locke, dead man, is alive on the island. Pretty mysterious. Our Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award goes to Matthew Avedon, who gets shot and then falls down.
Falls all the way off the show.
Falls all the way off the show.
Into
French. Through the icy lake of dual universes into French. I only spoiled like one season of French. Don't worry about it.
That's fine.
All right. Guess I'm out of the book club.
We already talked about it.
Oh, the Christmas Carol. Fair enough. The Saeed Jarrah reverse button watch. This does not have the purple shirt after much talk of the purple shirt. This one, he's in a yellow shirt. So
it's a little on the tighter side, so we're getting some muscle.
Speaking Spanish, too. He's a very good. He is a muy bien.
So this week, Saeed is causing buttons to become undone. We're just not sure where those buttons are.
We're not sure
around
where
around the world.
It's the Ben's talking, so it's obviously a lie award goes to Ben, who says, John, you can't die. You've got too much work to do. Then he murders him. It's a woo-loo-loo, the best time travel moment. Widmore tells John he jumped forward 3 whole years. So John Locke, jumping back and forth, comes straight out of an episode where he did something like 8 time jumps, then jumps into the normal timeline. Thank you, John Locke from the Rewatch podcast that was trying to track timelines. Hopefully this makes it a whole bunch easier. It's time for the best part of the week. This is the Jungle of Kistery moment where we decide who, what person and concepts, what other people need to be kissing on this show filled with very attractive and talented actors. Let's talk about the Jungle of Kistery. Where did we land last week for 316, Joanna?
Last week was a weird little crop, but I'm pretty excited with how it turned out. So last week was 316. Let's start at the bottom with Saeed and Alana. Nobody really seemed into Alana and Saeed, so that's
fine.
We
don't know much about Alana yet. So
yes, they both got such good curly hair, though. All right, and the handcuffs. Come on. All right, Jin and some hair product got 23.8. Oh, I should say, Saeed and Alana only got 9.5% of the vote. Jin and some hair product. We saw Jin in a Dharma jumpsuit bust out of the jungle with some great hair. 23.8% of the vote. Hurley and his 78 people that Hurley saved, 25.4% of the vote. A big mwah to Hurley and his altruism, but running away. Not since Jin loved camping have we seen a result like this one. Frank and Guam, 41.3% of the vote. So welcome to the Kistery Hall of Fame, Frank Lapidus.
And Guam.
I mean, it was bound to happen at some point for Frank, honestly.
All right, so this week is another tough one. I swear things are going to get much kissier soon. But this week, The Life and Death of Jeremy Bentham, a really bummer episode to talk about Kistery, but we're going to do our best. We're putting Helen and John in here, the what might have been of Helen and John, right? We're going to put Walt in his Wheaties because it's been 3 years, and as Matthew Abaddon notes, Walt got pretty tall. So Walt in his Wheaties. Shannon and Nadia in the afterlife, that comes from our listener Melissa. So that's just like justice for all the women that Saeed killed with his cursed dick.
This was also billed as Saeed's Saeed's dead lovers.
The ghost, but Elsa didn't make the cut.
Oh, poor Elsa.
Just Shannon and Nadia. All right, and then lastly, we're going to give it up to the our favorite Garden of Eden biblical imagery. It's John and the mango. So there we go. John smooching some tropical fruit. He's missed that mango. You know, like I have lived on an island and I have lived on a mainland and the fruit is just way worse here. That's just true. So welcome back to the good mangoes, John. You deserve it.
John came all the way back to the island for those good mangoes.
All right, make sure to follow us on Storm Podcast on Twitter to vote in that poll. The Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award could go to two people this episode, but we're going to give it to the one who stays dead, Matthew Abaddon. Hey, I'm just your driver. Pew, 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 pew. Then he's dead.
Also, I think eventually we're going to have to reconsider whether we should take John's award from last week back. Because you really should stay dead if you're going to have final awards.
That's true. And also, John's award from last week weren't even his final words. His final words are something like, do you know Eloise Hawking or something crazy like that. Anyway, not satisfying. Frank Lapidus says, guess we're not going to Guam. Kistery Act Break Award goes to John Locke, who says, my name is John Locke, appearing on the island in the suit he was supposed to be buried in.
Okay, I have to ask you guys this question, because every time I rewatch that opening scene where John reveals himself, it's got a real Star Warsy vibe.
Oh, yeah, yeah, like the Obi-Wan hoodie. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I love that. I love to believe that that's intentional.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Definitely.
Like, I half expect John to, like, put his hand on R2-D2 right after he's like, I'm John Locke.
John Locke. That's a name of course, I haven't heard in a long time.
R2-D2 always knows where the island is and can get there wherever he wants. He just chooses not to tell anyone.
That little jerk.
It's time for the official podcast check-in. There was an official Lost podcast where they would answer questions from the listeners. David and Lindelof and Carlton Cuse, the showrunners, in real time as the show was airing. This week we have a check-in that is a very interesting fan theory. I'm going to be reading Carlton Cuse, and Neil's going to be reading Damon Lindelof. Here we go.
Can you tell that Dave is feeling anxious about how long this podcast is?
We got to tighten it up. But also tell people what each corner means.
It's all right, Slowpoke Gonzalez. You got this.
Oh, racist. All right, Carlton Cuse says, and she's reading this. Hey, guys, it's your faithful fan, Nevitz, here. I don't know if Nevitz is a first name or a last name, but Nevitz is from Queensland, Australia.
Oh.
Okay, so I'm sure you probably heard by now the ever-popular Sawyer four-toed statue theory. Have you heard of this?
I think that I know where you're going with this, but I'm curious to see if I'm right.
Well, if you haven't, it basically states that because the scene where Sawyer gets something caught in his foot in the lie was so damn random, that it must mean that Sawyer ends up having his toe amputated because of infection, heroically saves the island's original inhabitants, and they, as grateful people as they are, create a giant statue of his foot in all its four-toed glory as a large token of their appreciation.
Wow, guys.
Loving the puns today.
If you want Carlton to read your question, just put horrible puns embedded in it.
So please tell me this isn't true. I think I'd rather die of laughter if it were. Oh, and I meant to ask, if Damon and Carlton were to marry, which one of you would change your last name? The fan base needs to know whether to call you Mr. and Mrs. Cuse or Lindelof.
Mr. and Mr.
Wow. I would answer the first part of the question by saying, rest assured, Sawyer will not be having his toe amputated anytime soon. So,
okay.
Just as a result of that, I think you can draw your own conclusions as to whether or not there is a statue of him. As far as the second part, were Carl and I to be married, I think that there would probably be, we would probably hyphenate.
That's true. That would be fair. And scene. All right, guys, we're going to continue our discussion of the life and death of Jeremy Bentham in the storm after this.
Now is the time on the podcast where we like to thank our Patreon subscribers at the $10 level or above. We got a whole bunch of newbies this week. I think they wanted to hear Dave Chen and me talk about Joss Whedon. So, or maybe it was Britney Spears. Who knows what they wanted to hear, but here they are. So we would like to thank James Devers, or Devors, Malik Birkenfeld, Electric Sheep TV, Michael Lisi, Ashley Lopez, Connor Rock, James, Matt Gray, JP Gagan, CJ, Trish, Anthony Mamo, Sabina Syed, Cameron Karis Sconyers, Erica Kremenek, Jonathan Kedmenek, Jennifer Carnivale, I say it that way because that's how Bobby Carnivale, anyway,
it's got some
let
flair,
me know if that's
yeah.
wrong. Let me know that's wrong, okay? Alejandra Pozos, Sarah Finnamore, Nikki Hyde, and Damon Van Vuren. Thank you guys so much.
And I would like to add to that thanks Josh, Mary Henderson, Seth Freelich. Hi, Seth. Corinne Ball, Jessica Scott, Matthew Wilson, Sarah Cooper, Jeff Libby, Brian, Matthew Munden, Mark Rodriguez, Jessica Trowbridge, Jay Fornes, Patrick Grattan, Francis Adrian, Kevin Gonzalez. Oh, it's my brother.
Oh, Kev.
Hi, Kevin. I'm glad you got vaccinated. Jay Maggio, Eric Procyse, Arthur Wynn, and Scott Rumsey. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine human beings: Richard Hoska, Tracy, Luke Sweet, Nate, Jason, Timothy May, Eric Manley, Danielle Steer, Joseph Lucis, Francis Adrian, Ralph Helm, Chelsea Patchell, Samuel Fry, Andrew Nikovich, Fran Bull, Sam, Tony Rollins, Courtney Swanson, Akil Kassam, Elizabeth Maxiner, Elizabeth Gelly, Jess Paul, Kayla Hagman, Doc Zuhl? Yeah, okay, that feels right. Nicholas Barkley, and Catherine Lemreese. Thank you all very much for being members of the Small Council.
Hey And we're back in the high energy storm where I increased the volume of my voice to make me feel like I have not been podcasting for 2 hours before starting the storm.
First things first, that's not John Locke.
Yeah, first things first, not John Locke. Thus we begin the period of the podcast where my performance art of having an opinion in the first season of a rewatch podcast really is its most tightwire walk, where every week I will be arguing now in the calm that guy's John Locke, who's still a villain. Well, here we know that he just actually is the villain, and John Locke died a very sad man. Rewatching this episode's a real trip.
Yeah.
Just like, because the other thing I also forgot is this is the last waltz. This is the last new waltz.
Mm-hmm. Other than the postscript that we get on the show.
That is not on the show.
Oh, it's a DVD extra. The Man in Charge?
Is a DVD extra. It says the last waltz that appears in the main series. There is stock footage of him later on, but this is last waltz.
That's the one extra that I'm like, but that's really, I just like to misremember it as really being part of the series. So,
yeah.
Anyway,
I also, we talked about this, correct, and we'll get there. I'm not sure. I liked it a lot more when it was giving me answers, but now that I've lived with the whole show, I kind of don't like it. But we'll get there. All right. Before we get to some storm emails, let's talk amongst us a little bit more about Jon Snow Jesus. John Locke Jesus. I'm just so used to applying that to a different John. You know, here we are in a different resurrected John. Is this working, or does this seem like super sad in hindsight?
Both. It works and it's super sad.
Yeah, and I think the fun part about the rewatch is watching it with the context that this is the Man in Black acting in John's body, and it's very fun. It makes, I think, this season a very fun rewatch. But I am curious to see how any Calmies are gonna take this. How long does it take them to figure out that something's wrong with John?
I will say all the recappers, except for Jeff Jensen, who probably had some insider set knowledge, have swallowed this hook, line, and sinker. Jeff says something about, like, or is this some sort of Christian Shepherd-esque? I was like, all right, a little too on the nose there, Jeff Jensen.
Nice theory.
I mean, I've done similar, but all the other recappers are like, well, did Ben know that John would come back? Like, when he killed him, like, was this, you know, he was the one who was so insistent John's body be brought. Did he know that this is just like a temporary death to get them where they need to go, or like whatever? The answer is no. this was not Ben's plan. This is not John Locke. So yeah,
I definitely think it works. It really makes it stand out that we don't get a lot of time. We don't get any time to mourn John Locke, right? The entire series that I could think about. Like, there is a lot of talk about, like, dishonoring his name with Jack, and then we get the whole flash sideways, which is the actual conclusion of the character, I think. But we don't get a point to really mourn the loss of John Locke, because we're just right in the flock. And I've forgotten, you know, how quickly that happens. But it's kind of sad in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sad because you don't, as a first-time watcher, you don't realize it until we're not going to get the answer until, like, the last couple episodes of this season, if not the finale.
It's the finale, yeah.
Yeah, so it is interesting because I would imagine that there's a certain element of, like, we're mourning Locke kind of now, but we really do believe that, you know, that this is the same John Locke, and it really isn't until after. And then I think it's just you're too far away from it, and there's too much other stuff that happens in the immediate aftermath of finding out that this is the Man in Black wearing John Locke's bodysuit.
I mean, I will say that for all of that, the finale revelation does give you, like, the full summer hiatus to think about, or longer, I forget the exact release of the final seasons, but, like, to think about holy shit, John Locke's really dead, mm-hmm. right? Like,
and he got swindled, essentially.
Yeah, and it's so sad. And maybe you go and rewatch that season, you know, like, you know, we would have, if we were podcasting about it at the time, we would rewatch mm-hmm. season five before season six started, and we'd be like, oh man, that's fucking tough. Oh, so sad. So yeah, I don't know. I think the best it does to honor him and mourn him is Jack's defense of him and appreciation for him that Dave mentioned in that final mm-hmm. season where yeah. Jack oh, is yeah, just that, sort of like
where he's like that's not this isn't John, you're not John Locke.
Yeah.
You're disgracing his yeah. memory and stuff like that.
That means so much that Jack
and then he grows punches to be him yeah. next to the sea a lot.
Jumps and yeah. falcon jump punch. Punches him. Grief punch. Boom. Right in the kiss there. So, yeah. I don't know. It's interesting.
Abaddon, who does he really work for? We touched about this a little bit in the calm, but do you have a storm answer, Joanna, that like you think he's a Jacob? He's been touched by the Jacob?
I feel like him trying to get John to the island, that just you're right, it's probably a retcon that they had a different plan for him and then they decided that he worked for Widmore, but it just like that seems like such a Jacoby move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, it really like, felt like he was like off island Richard for a while,
getting
but then
Alana,
Richard's off island too.
Well, getting Alana, like Alana in the hospital and stuff like that, like I could see that as a Jacob, like that's Jacob visiting Alana in the hospital, but that always strikes me as super weird. And that seems like something like an Abaddon should do. You know what
there's
I mean?
Mm-hmm. There's part of me that now when you're saying this is like, was Lance Reddick going to be Jacob? But then I remember the show probably isn't race forward enough to be actually thinking about that at this point.
But could it'd be he, really cool he if been. He had been.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, and you can see a world in which
the Jacob finally.
Yeah, I mean, you can see in a world in which Abaddon is doing the thing where that Jacob does, where he like goes and touches the candidates' lives, and that makes more sense than Jacob being able to project himself off the island like that, right?
I think.
Remember
so.
Remember how Jacob just like goes to Sun and Jin's wedding,
like, right? Like Jacob just all of a sudden is like all over the world.
Does Jacob have shore leave all the time? I have questions about how that works. You know what I mean?
It would have been easier if it were Abaddon.
He can't live in the Sawyer statue forever.
Sawyer statue. There's also the whole like Abaddon was Walt. A time traveling Walt theory. I think we've talked about that before. That just feels racist. So that's all.
Sure.
Yeah. Really tall racist. Walt.
Not really everyone tall. Can be time traveling Walt. Only one time traveling Walt.
And he's wet and he's electronic. That's yep. it.
And he's only talking to Shannon.
Before we get to questions and emails, a note that I thought we talked about in the calm is traveled here to the storm. We've introed Caesar and Alana. Mm-hmm. How is that going?
I mean, it sucks. I think Caesar and Alana suck as characters. And I think they realize that and then they get rid of them. We also, I watched a little bit ahead. And that's when Coover from Justified shows up and he also sucks. He's in the like Alana Caesar gang. Because a lot of these meat mm-hmm. socks are actually like the
Jacob army.
You know, Jacob army or whatever. It all sucks. And then they're just like, oops, never mind. And then they try the temple and they're like, oops, never mind. So I just want to appreciate. I just want to take this moment and say Ben, Juliet, Dan, Miles, Lapidus, Charlotte. You guys were great.
No, you can't give it to Charlotte and then say that Caesar and Alana are bad in this episode.
Okay, fine. Not Charlotte. Not you, Charlotte. So Juliet, Frank. Juliet, Ben, Frank, Miles, Dan. And we talked about this at the time when the Fraides got there, like how intelligently they introduced them and what a great job they did. And it just like doesn't work for the Tailies or the Temple People or Caesar and Alana or Nikki and Paolo, that they like that Lost has all these misfires at trying to introduce new blood. Desmond, of course, is another great thing that worked. So
You know that thing when you're rewatching a show that you haven't seen in a while where as it's going, you start to remember deeper and deeper into it. And it's like, oh, I remember what's coming. As you know, I recently rewatched all of season 5 of Lost in anticipation of doing this season. And as I was watching it, I spent a lot of time, probably too much time, trying to remember where the storyline for Caesar and Alana ends. And I still, honestly, I know it has something to do with the temple. I have no idea what happens to them. And I've seen this show before. That is how insignificant they are.
They have to bring John's body to the shadow of the temple, right? To Sawyer's.
They've got John's body.
So they've got John's body. And then, like, Alana is, like, for a while, she's, like, spearheading the, like, fuck Smokey. She's there to answer a lot of lore questions, right? And she does. She answers some. And then she just gets blown up by some dynamite. So stupid. And Caesar, I actually genuinely forget. He must get stabbed or something. And I just rewatched it, like, recently. But it doesn't matter, because, you know.
It's like, just weird to, like, see a character show up on screen and be like, oh my god, okay, I remember Caesar and Alana, but I don't remember anything that happens to them, because it's really not that important.
Doesn't matter.
Other than the reveal that they still have John Locke's body, what are they good for?
And Coover, sorry, I don't know that actor's name, but I think he gets, like, super, like, tossed about by the smoke monster. Like, they come down and try to, like, down into the foot to try to, like, deal with the smoke monster. And the smoke monster's like, look what I could do. It just, like, kills the shit out of him. But he was a really annoying character anyway, so it doesn't matter. Anyway, these are just distractions. But Caesar and Alana, they're here. I wish they were better. It's not really the actor's fault.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it is. Oh, Brad William Henke.
Yeah,
comes. He shows up. Yeah. That's, oh yeah, he's from Justified.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very interesting for them to try and throw more characters into the mix that, like, know the game, right? That know.
Yeah.
Like, the big game of, like, the Jacob and Men in Black thing, where they've spent such a good. I mean, they've, I don't know if they've hidden it or they just haven't gotten to it yet, but it's weird to throw a bunch of, like, it almost makes them feel overpowered, like we talk about in superhero movies, where it's like this, now we have characters who have too much information.
Well, and it's frustrating because, like, I'm like, why does Alana know more than Richard? That bothers
me. Stuff like that.
You know? And I'm just sort of like, Richard should be the source of all of this. He can still have his crisis of faith that he has. It's really powerful in the final season, I think. But like, he can have, you don't need an Alana, I don't think. You don't need, like, it's just all this Jacob's army stuff is
Do you think that
Dumbledore's army, and that's pretty bad.
Here's the big bet question. How many Kisteries do you think either Caesar or Alana are going to make? How many polls will they make? Last, like, 20 episodes or
and
so.
That's so stupid because they're, like, dumb hot, but, like, they just don't work. It's like Nikki Palo. Those people are dumb hot. I don't think we put good old Nikki Pals on that many, you know.
Yeah, maybe just the one. Well, I'm curious to see if they get nominated at any point organically. I'm
all
sure
right, we will, okay, how about this? We will not we will not nominate them, but if someone else wants to nominate. Well, I already did. I nominated Alana and Saeed, but nobody was biting. Anyway, they don't work. That's the point. And it's just fun to think about characters that do and characters that don't. I think the temple people really don't work either, despite John Hawks being the love of my life. So, you know, it happens.
All right, is it time for some spoilery emails?
Yeah, I think it's just the back half of Grant's that I need to do here. Yes. Okay, so we're going to pick up where we left off with Grant's email about we are the causes of our own suffering, and how they always planned that the flashbacks were kind of time travel stories to begin with, right? Okay. But here's the quote. We're going to pick up with this quote from Damon Lindelof. We knew a bunch of things early on. One of the things that we knew for a very long time was that the series was going to end with Jack's death. That would be the end of his arc. The symmetry of starting with his eye opening and ending with his eye closing felt really good to us. But then, because Lost was a show that finally reveled in nonlinear storytelling and liked to jump around in time, we started to become very enamored of the idea that although the final image of the final season would be Jack's eyes closing, we could show his entire experience post-death in some way. Trojan horsed inside the show. And how could we hide it? How would we give the audience what we felt the audience had been demanding from the pilot, which is, this is purgatory. Are they all dead? Because when someone asks you a question, I believe, because this is how it is with me, they're really telling you what they want. Back at, so that's the end of the Damon Lindelof quote, that they decided to do this purgatory because people kept theorizing that the island was purgatory. And they're like, oh, you want purgatory? We'll give you purgatory and you'll never see it coming. All right. And then this is Grant again. Back at the end of season one, Sun asked if they were being punished for the things they'd done before the crash, if it was their destiny to suffer. Season two opened with a reference to the book The Third Policeman, a surreal novel where we eventually discover the protagonist is dead and repeating the same story over and over. Another reference to this type of fiction happens later in the season with the more famous occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, which has also been adapted to a Twilight Zone episode. Later, the name of the island deity could read as a reference to Jacob's Ladder, a film that is entirely a bardo occurring after the protagonist's death. The truth is that Lost writers wanted to couch an afterlife plot Trojan horse into the show through its time travel conceit. Let's step back a minute and think about the purpose of time travel as a storytelling device. Even in the first season of the fifth, in the first scene of the fifth season, they discussed how this was going to work. Quote, so what? We're going to go back in time and kill Hitler? A random Dharma worker asks. Don't be absurd, Pierre Chang replies. There are rules, rules that can't be broken. They then execute a plot in which one of the 815 survivors, Saeed, who is very good, tries to murder the villain who caused them the most grief, a young Benjamin Linus. As you might expect, this has the effect of ensuring that Ben becomes the person who causes them the most grief in the future. But this is a pattern that happens throughout the season, where a survivor's action or inaction causes things from the first four seasons to occur. Locke doesn't shoot a young Widmore. He'll grow up to send the freighter that terrorizes the castaways. Juliet and Sawyer rescue a young woman from the two others, and she will later give birth to Ethan Rome, who kidnapped Claire in season one. James in the 70s could get off island and attempt to stop his father from killing his mother, but he doesn't. Jack and the team attempt to detonate Jughead, thereby causing the incident that will inevitably lead to the crash of A-15. We are the causes of our own suffering. When we revisit Room 23 in Season 6, after our time travel escapades have concluded, the camera lingers on the still of that message. The past that made us who we are can't be changed. We often wish we could go back and say something different or take another course of action that should have been obvious at the time. We wallow in it because our consciousness is a diaspora of thoughts and memories moving in only one direction. We can look back, but we can't ever reach back. So this is the bardo stuff that I'm going to skip over, but it's great stuff. We've just covered it before.
Yeah, watch True Detective season 2, the best season of True Detective.
And then I'm going to end here with what Grant says personally. He says, on a personal note, I think a lot about the sideways world for what it means to the characters, Jack in particular. In recent years, my life underwent monumental changes, but I carried a lot of heartache. I suffer from a few anxiety and depression disorders, and I lost a marriage along the way. Recently, I become a father for the first time, and I reflect long and hard that without all the heartache, without all the pain, without losing a marriage, my son wouldn't be here. How can I stay angry about all that came before when he existed in part because of that pain? And I know the pain he's likely to experience in his life, I'll need to help him through. I'll recognize myself in him and need to be kind to him, which is, in a way, being kind to myself as a younger man. That's somewhat how I've been thinking about Jack and his sideways son, David. It's himself he's learning to be kind to. We are the causes of our own suffering, not because the other people don't hurt us, they do. It's if we allow ourselves to focus only on that past hurt and our inability to change what has come before that causes that suffering. And learning to let go and live our authentic selves in the presence, we can forge ahead together and be reborn into whatever comes next. That's the message I take away from these final two seasons. And it's what I feel the whole series is looking to tell us from the start. I'll see you in another life, Grant. So.
Great stuff.
Yeah.
Yep.
I like all of that. It makes me dislike season three because they didn't know how to make it as much a big piece, but it makes me like the rest of Lost from that view. I'm really interested to see if we're doing a disservice to our calmies by not leading into the final season of the show the way the show doesn't. Because if I remember correctly, coming back from the incident at the beginning of season 6, you think it's like an alternate reality. You think it's some sci-fi shit because Juliet just detonated a nuclear bomb on a alternate universe thing. And so you kind of miss a bunch of the nuance because you don't know what you're watching. And so I'm wondering if like we're going to have that same problem with our Calmies.
It's going to be really tough. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry. But like I found it tough in this week's episode to talk about John this way. Like I think that's it's per our policy. We talked about it before we started recording. It's per our policy, but like I feel way weirder pretending that this is John than I did about pretending Jin was dead, you know.
Yeah. Well, because it's antithetical to what the show is about. The show is about the characters, but as I was saying, and trying to lay some groundwork for our poor people, I think season 5's plot pulled some character things, and there's a little bit of cart before the horsiness, and John Flock is one of those things where it's like, it's a great mystery, but did we do it at the expense of focusing in on the island mystery, who's the leader of the others, what's the war coming, when really we could have been doubling down on, you know, John visited Walt. Like, that's the show. The show is not John gets resurrected because he's a smoke monster. So, I mean, to be fair, that's the show. But I'm wondering if going forward, if we ourselves in the Calm should start laying some groundwork to pivot back to character.
Well, okay, here's a question. Actually, a thought and a question. My first thought is, we are doing a great job of hiding things. They have no idea that Vincent is Jacob. It's going to be amazing, and that's for any Call Me who has listened too long. The second thing is, I remember vividly how angry people were about what happens to John. Like, they think it's very unfair to Locke, and it is. And I don't know if I want to rob them of that. Like, there is a feeling
that anger.
When you get to the end of season 5, you're going to feel some kind of way about the twist that John, that is not John, that now we are in Jacob and his brother land and crazy stuff is happening. I think that it is a valuable thing to be able to have that emotion at the moment when the show wants you to have that emotion. Unless you're a Call Me with reckless abandon and you just heard me give away the absolute ending about Vincent. So, so yeah, I mean, that's sort of where I land on it, is like, it feels weird to fake it for us because we know the answer. And I bet that other people listening to the Storm section probably have had these things with friends who are also watching a show that they've watched before, but it really just comes back to, like, I think they should get to have that experience, because that is a defining experience of Lost. That's one of the defining experiences of watching Lost. Regardless of how you feel about it, there's going to be a strong feeling about how fairly John Locke was treated in these last two seasons.
My only counter argument to that is, if I tell anyone to watch Game of Thrones, I don't let them think Jon Snow is dead when he dies. Like, it's just like, that's just like,
well, no one's ever going to have to suffer the way we did and watch it. Like,
well, I mean, right? But like, suffer the way we did. The way we did is he died and we're like, and open your eyes and open your eyes. Well, right. And they're like, nope, next season. And we're like, what the fuck? Like,
but everyone who watches it in perpetuity can just go to the next episode where he's, or like two episodes later where he's alive again. You know,
I literally just saw a tweet where someone wrote, like, sits up straight in bed. Why the fuck did they have him fuck his aunt if it literally was going to mean nothing? Perpetually so many questions about that. They thought they did something with John Snow, you know what I mean? So.
But yeah, so I think it's important enough to be a real, legitimate spoiler, I think.
All right. Personally. We'll let them.
Not that spoilers matter, because it's always about execution, Dave.
We'll let them come.
And it's all about how they execute.
We'll let them come to the temple and think the sideways is an alternate universe. It's like we're hitting the end of Lost too close to the MCU taking a multiverse for them to get as fast as they could.
I do
think we're going to get more people jumping into the storm from the Calm. in the final season, because it does get confusing. And yeah. You know.
Let's keep thinking about it. And if you guys have suggestions, please email us, hostatstormpodcast.com. I do have one more email to read.
Do it.
That I forgot.
Sure.
About. Is that okay? Yeah. All right. There's a there is a trigger warning for this episode, there's a trigger warning for this email about suicide. So, all right. This comes from Matthew.
I'm sorry. Should we have put a trigger warning at the beginning of this episode?
Oh, I meant we did it in when the live watch.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Presumably, if you're listening to a podcast about an episode of television, you know what that episode of television is about. We put a trigger warning in the Slack before we started watching the episode on Saturday.
Fair. Okay. Just wanted to be clear.
So I know we've been talking about it this whole episode, but anyway.
Sure.
Matthew writes, when Lost first premiered in 2004, I was 14, and Walkabout was something that opened my eyes to what a television series could be capable of. Lost became my obsession throughout high school and most of college, and while I loved the characters of Desmond, Ben, and Dan, my favorite was Locke. He was someone who life dealt a shitty hand, and on the island he found what he believed was his purpose. He was literally repaired, at least physically and occasionally spiritually, by the island. Locke came from an abusive family, and he dealt with constant self-doubt and depression like me. When Locke stood ready to kill himself because he didn't know what else to do, I empathize with his plight because I would attempt suicide a few years later. Initially, when he is resurrected on the island, I assume my Locke had come back and his death solved his problems. But that would have been irresponsible for Lindelof and Cus to do. I think it would imply that there is a better existence after our first lives, and all we have to do is hurry up and die, which they do to some degree in season 6, but I think I'll have another email around the finale. Our lives, like the characters in the show, are filled with both comedy and tragedy. We have to accept it in order to move on and become the people we're meant to be. I only wish Locke could have experienced it before his death. So it goes, Matthew. So, I just thought that was a really good email. I know that a lot of people take the Locke story very personally. We've heard that from people over the how long have we been doing this podcast. I think Locke is the character that just inspires the most emotional reactions for people because his story ends where it does, and because of just the tragedy of it, that like other characters are given the chance, like Locke in this episode is never able to unbury himself from that damage that was done to him as a kiddo. You know, Jack at least is able to sort of dig himself out of that hole a bit before he dies, you know? And, you know, presumably like Kate and Sawyer and Hurley and stuff like that are able to get to better places as well. But for Locke, it doesn't happen. And that's just really, really fucking sad. And that's why this is, I don't like sob during this episode the way that I do like when Charlie dies or when the raft launches from the beach. Or there's other moments that like make me cry every single time. It just hurts. This episode really hurts to watch. It's very good television. So,
before we head out, I would be remiss if we didn't pose a question about baby Alex. Because that was a promise. And here in High Energy Storm, we keep our promises.
Thank you. I have an answer. Okay, so Anna wants to know what the fuck did Ben do with little baby Alex after he stole her? If Alex was born in 1988, stolen soon thereafter, and the Dharma side wasn't until the early 90s, are we to believe he just showed up at Dharmaville with a baby and told Horace and Roger what exactly? I found this baby in the forest. I'm going to raise her as my own. Or did he just leave her with Richard or, spoiler, Dojin in a few years? I need your theories and explanations. I believe it's explained in that he leaves her with Widmore for a while, right?
Oh, with Widmore.
Mm-hmm. Because Widmore's leaving the others at the time.
I like the idea of him leaving her with Richard because there's a good like side spinoff. Is Richard raising Alex?
I would watch it.
In their little camp.
Can you imagine how much better Alex's life would be if like Richard had been her foster dad? Her dad?
Yeah.
I mean, also, why didn't Richard just give her back to I mean, this is the thing about Richard. You want to love him, but he has really just sort of stood idly by some really deeply disturbing shit.
Be careful when God, it turns out to be the white guy telling you what to do. It just never works out right. Didn't we learn that in Star Trek V, people? All right. I think that does it for this week in the life and death of Jeremy Bentham. But don't worry. There's a lot more Lost to come, just no more Real Lock until season 6. So, where are we going next week, Neil, for one of the best episodes of Lost?
Well, bring your giant dandelions, because we're heading to Dharmaville, and we're getting romantic with LaFleur.
LaFleur, it's just a really good the Juliet and Sawyer stuff is a lot, it's great, but it's just a really good episode anyway.
We also get to see the full Sawyer statue, which is good.
Oh, and we get to meet all the new Dharmies. That's not what they're called, but I just called them that. It's a lot.
Oh,
a lot
and
happens.
What's his name? Phil.
Phil.
Phil and Richard.
Can't stand Phil.
Snitsky or whatever. Or maybe we don't meet him till the one after. But and then we get the most iconic Sawyer gif of all time, which isn't the flower. Mm-hmm. It isn't the Juliets are kissing. It's his, like, Dr. Alan Grant saw a dinosaur for the first time, taking off his glasses moment when he sees Jack and Kate and Hurley. So
mm-hmm.
It's a big moment. I asked Diana to make a GIF mashing those two up. We'll see if she does it. I can do it if she does it. Hurley taking his glasses off. It's a really famous gif, and it's used a lot. And it's a spoiler free gif to use because they usually don't show the reverse shot, so you don't know what he's looking at. Mm-hmm. But he's looking at the Losties. They're back to fuck his entire life up. His whole nice life is about to get screwed over, you know. And we find, like, you know, anyway, I'll stop talking about it. We're going to talk about it next week.
Yeah, next week. Yeah, I bet we'll spend a whole 2.5 hours talking about it. It'll be fantastic.
Okay, Dave. Loosen up.
So, until next week, you know who we're not going to forget to talk about this week? Joanna Robinson, where could people find more of you around the internet?
Oh, vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. I'm doing a podcast about WandaVision called Still Watching : WandaVision. This week we've got Paul Bettany, who you might have heard of, on the podcast. So there you go.
You preachers, Paul Bettany? Oh, wait, no, what it was called? The Priest. Not Preacher. He's not a preacher. He's in The Priest. That's his vampire.
No, it's Wimbledon's Paul Bettany. Yeah, well,
fair. And Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can get me at filmschoolrejects.com. We can also, you can get me on Twitter at rejects. And if you are a member of our Patreon, patreon.com/stormofspoilers, jump into the Slack, stream together, watch alone is the channel. Pushing Daisies is the delightful fucking show that we are watching right now, and it is crushing. So join us for Pushing Daisies. Did I miss anything? Nope, that's it.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast. And here every week, doing my very small contribution, but very important contribution to your life, which is reminding you, don't fall down. It is very dangerous no matter your age. And it's actually super cold right now outside, so watch out for, like, ice and falling down. Just be careful. Don't fall down. See you next week.